Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, February 3rd, 2020. Time is really flying here. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, go to National Liberty Alliance and click on our .org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions into questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, consider supporting NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on our right side of our website, the top right side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be in the Gospel of Mark. It is the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 1 through 12. And he, Jesus, arose from thence, and cometh unto the coast of Judea by the farther side of Jordan. And the people resort unto him again, and as he was wont, he taught them again. And the Pharisees came to him and asked him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife, tempting him? And he answered and said unto them, What did Moses command you? And they said, Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away. And Jesus answered and said unto them, For the hardness of your heart he wrote you this precept. But from the beginning of the creation God made them male and female. For this cause shall man leave his father and mother, and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So then they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. And in the house his disciples asked him again of the same matter. And he said unto them, Whosoever shall put away his wife, and marry another, committeth adultery against her. And if a woman shall put away her husband, and be married to another, she committeth adultery. This is the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 1 through 12. Okay, tonight we're just going to make a few announcements on some of the things we're doing and going forward with, and we're going to try to move into open conversation quickly, probably right after, of course, after Brent takes the mic for a while. But I'm going to try to make myself pretty quick. Just want to make some announcements and some things that people need to be considering to do. You know, we're working with the militias across the nation. We're trying to really get militias up and going on the grassroots level in every county, on a county level. And some of the things we're doing for that, of course, is we're not looking to take any kind of a leadership control over things. We're here to facilitate for people to organize, communicate, and educate themselves in the processes that they should be taken hold of and participating in. Particularly, everyone should be participating in the militia. So everybody should get out there and sign up to register for the militia. And then as they develop, when you get 6 to 12 people in the counties, then you'll start some local meetings and start doing things you need to do. So again, we're here to educate and facilitate a place for that education, and also for the organizing within the counties and for people to communicate to each other within those counties and from county to county and state to state, even ultimately on a national level. But everything is grassroots, and that's what we're trying to construct. Okay, the other thing, of course, is we're building, administrations for the grand juries and the trial juries. We're looking for 4 administrators in each county. We need 4. This is a full-time paid position, by the way. Once it gets executed, right now the government controls this. This needs to be controlled by the people. It never should have been taken away from the people. And of course, the government has to pay for its execution or its exercising of the right of juries. And so anyway, we're looking for 4 individuals in each county. And you don't have to work in the same county you live in. You just go online, sign up to become an administrator. You can find that on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and it should be under grand jury. You know, you can click to become a grand jury administrator. And it's a matter of checking the boxes and start educating yourself. Anybody who's participating in the jury as administrators or participating with committee band process, those 2 particular need to take all of our courses. Okay, we have a civics course, and we have a militia course, and we have a government by consent course. Government by consent course is the most important one. It's the first one that people should take. It does require participation on a higher level. We're expecting people to be premier members. The premier member is someone given $5 a month or more to gain access into our government by consent course. The other courses are free. You don't have to be, let me think on the militia. I don't think we require anything on the militia or course, I know we don't, and on the civics course. Those anybody can take. You do have to be a member to sign in and get registered into that. Okay, anyway, if you want to become an administrator, get in there, click the check the box, and start getting educated. Anybody, we've helped a lot of people in the past, or at least we've tried to help a lot of people in the past. People come in, they'll click into us and ask for help. We participate to do what we can for them, and then all of a sudden they disappear. And then we don't hear from them no more. We're not interested in those people. We're interested in people who are going to do the right thing. Freely we have been given, so freely we must give, okay? And that's the same thing with anyone else that participates. If you want us to assist you in any way, then we expect that you're going to become educated. We will educate you. You can take your time on it, but you must become educated. You must start, supporting the things that we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance. You need to consider very seriously to become, to register with the militia for sure. And also everybody should consider to become a committee man at least once in their lifetime. But look, we're going to help you. You need to help others. Whatever you learn, you need to teach others. And again, we're not interested in people that are just coming in here. They just want to get our assistance. They're not interested in our education. They want to get a private meeting maybe and all these other things. We're not interested in doing those things. So let's help each other and do the right thing, what we need to do. So anybody who wants to become a committee man, you can go up there. And again, everybody should be educating themselves for it right now anyway. Get to understand what it is. And even if you decide not to do it this year, that's fine. Maybe 2 years down the line or 10 years down the line. But at some point in time, you have a duty to participate in the political process in the way that we have set up originally our Constitution and the process of our political process the way it should really work. Participation in this across the nation will eliminate the politics in our political process. Let me repeat that. Participation on a national level for people taking control and actually taking back our right, our unalienable right to choose our government and put onto the ballot the people that we feel and believe are qualified, and that would be someone who understands the Constitution will uphold it, okay? Well, that is our unalienable right to do, okay? And this will eliminate politics, because politics will disappear once the political process is properly exercised. Anybody has any questions on that, we can discuss that in tonight's open forum or another time. Okay, Rudy Giuliani, he's posting podcast for indictment considerations. We're his grand jury, okay? We are going to listen very carefully to all that he has to say as an ex-prosecutor and an ex-mayor of New York City. And he is bringing that a prosecution, addressing the people through YouTube podcasts. Okay, if you go to our nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight the grand jury, and we did have a page. We don't have a date on it yet. We have an indictment consideration to be determined, is what we have. You click on that, okay, and that will give you the first two podcasts. That anybody that's going to participate in this one needs to review and listen to these podcasts. That is the evidence. We're going to try to have this scripted out, and we're going to list out all of the individuals that he brings up for potential indictment, and we're going to come together as a grand jury and decide whether we want to indict these individuals or not. But you must be thoroughly educated in the accusations against these people. So I'd say podcast number one, we didn't post. It was kind of an introduction and so on and so forth. Podcast number two is where it really starts. If you want to see podcast number one, go on to YouTube and YouTube it, and see you'll get podcast number one. But number two and number three is up there. He said this is going to take a couple of weeks. He hasn't been posting them every day. It's been every couple of days. He should be coming up with four maybe posted tonight, as a matter of fact. As soon as it's posted, we will be posting it up here. We are posting the short forms of these podcasts. The longer forms are about 45 to 60 minutes long, okay? I think it was SGT or somebody that took these podcasts and eliminated the front part and some other parts in between, sort of commercialing different things, and just got to the nuts and the bolts, okay? And brought each one of these podcasts down to maybe 25 minutes long. But please, if you're going to participate with this, which is probably going to be 3 to 4 weeks down the line when we're going to come together as a jurist, as grand jury, to consider indictments on all these individuals, you need to have reviewed through all these videos, these podcasts, and again, they're YouTube, so it's video audio. But you need to go through them. Don't wait till the last minute. Start now. If you're going to participate, go up and watch these two in the course of the next week, and you're going to find that there'll be probably two more by the time the end of the week is there. So you'll have four to catch up on, about 20, 25 minutes apiece. Make some notes as you go through this. Note an individual's name and maybe just a little thing about the crime that they're being accused of. Nothing, you don't have to get too dramatic on it on paper. Just need to understand so that when we bring these people's names up, you'll know who we're talking about. You'll be able to look on your list and say, yep. You could be making your decision as you go along, because this is progressive. It's constructive. It goes from one thing to another to another. Now, some people's names may be coming up all the time, some just occasionally. We're not going to be looking to, we may be, I don't know, we'll, you might want to make a note on this. People who are not necessarily citizens of this nation that is participating with this, we can indict them possibly. I think we can. We're going to think about that. We'll look into that. I'm pretty sure I've seen precedences on that, and maybe Brent has some knowledge on that. He can comment on that when he picks up the mic. But I think we can even indict. We do know they indicted people. They went after people when they were doing this Russian collusion thing, and they went after people in foreign corporations in Russia, and they indicted people. So, hey, I think we could do it too. So we'll find out for sure. We'll let you know, but keep your notes on individuals that are not necessarily citizens of this nation, but people from another nation. They come into our country, they could be arrested then. And there's plenty of situations. I've heard high figures over the past 20 or 30 years that have been indicted by other jurors, grand juries in other places outside of America, and in certain places, if they went to, they would be arrested. So the claim is, I don't know how true that is, but that's what I've heard. But we'll consider that as we go. So anyway, this Giuliani thing that he's going to, remember, he is a prosecutor, and he's indicting these people before the American people, before the public. We are those people. We are that grand jury. We have formed together, and anybody that wants to come to this, and you know, you can invite other people, even if they're not members of National Liberty Alliance, to come to this meeting to participate, as long as they have watched, listened to the podcasts. Anybody who comes into the room for the purpose of recording or what we're doing, or listening and spying on us, and anything of that nature, that's a jail sentence. It's going to be. There's no doubt we will. We will. I can't believe that we wouldn't indict those individuals, especially government agents coming in to spy out our liberties and maybe trying to use. It's illegal to spy on a grand jury when they're deliberating. So anybody wants to do that, they will be met with an indictment. I'm sure we will indict them. Okay. IRS indictments. IRS is one of the biggest frauds and the biggest destruction of our nation. We're going to be considering an IRS indictment this coming Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can find the indictment information under grand jury, second one down, indictment consideration, on 2620, okay? So there's one paper to read. There is two considerations of indictments that's being on this case. The first case is the IRS, and the other one is the federal judiciary. So those are the two indictments to be considered. If you read the IRS writ quo warranto that we drafted, and it's posted up there. You can click on that, and it's posted twice as evidence because it's evidence in both the IRS case and the federal judiciary case. And so read through that very carefully. I don't remember how many pages it is. In fact, let me just open it up and see. Okay. The quo warranto itself is 16 pages. It's double space or space and a half. I think it's double space. So it's not a long read. You can read it pretty quickly in 20 minutes, taking your time, reading it nice, and make sure you get comprehension of it, about 20 minutes, I'd say, if that. Okay, but after that is a total of 55 pages because we have all the evidence. So you want to skim down and view the evidence that we have against these people that we refer to. But we're going after IRS agents who are assaulting the people. We're going after the commissioner of the IRS who is leading this whole process and training and permitting the training of assault upon the people. Also the fact that they're acting outside of their authority. And that what they're doing is imposing a slave tax on the people. I think by the time you read the 16-page writ quo warranto, which is what it is written to them, once you read through it, I think you're going to pretty well see exactly how they're doing it and how unlawful it is at every step of the way. From them claiming they have authority, they have no authority. Read the paper, you'll see. Okay, so reading that paper is a requisite, a prerequisite of coming in as a jurist. And if you're going to come in as a jurist, then you'll cast your vote. And we're there just to really go through the charges against who the charges are on. And then we'll be voting and moving forward. We'll make some preliminary statements in the beginning of this potential indictment, and then we'll move on. Okay, there is also a couple others. We're writing a paper right now concerning the problem with our Second Amendment, particularly focusing in on the governor of Virginia in both houses and the governor of New York in both houses here too. And we're coming to the point where they're going to cease and stop, or we're going to start indicting. We will indict the governor of any state. We will indict any of these individuals in the legislature that think that they can take an oath of office, step up, and then betray the people. Okay, doesn't matter what they think or do or believe concerning the Second Amendment. That's irrelevant. Whatever is in their hearts to believe, they can have that. But when you step up and swore to uphold and defend and protect the Constitution, Well, then you have to lay all that aside. And if you're not capable of laying all that aside, then don't take that oath and don't take that office. Well, they've taken that oath and they've taken that office and they've used that office as a springboard in order to assault the people and take away our unalienable right, our Second Amendment right to defend ourselves against them, the tyrants, and also our right to come together as a militia and be armed militarily, as is required by common law. Okay, so this is what it's all about. This is the cutting edge. This is where, you know, the rubber meets the road, and this is the work that we're really working to do. Okay, we're also, we haven't posted the information yet. I'm still looking into this, and I'm sure we're going to be doing something on the pharmaceutical companies. There's some activity going on with another group. We're going to participate with that other group. They're giving us evidence. We're going to be considering indictments, and we're going to be moving forward on that. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll be going forward for considering indictments on the pharmaceutical companies. Okay. Let's see what else. Well, the SAFE Act, they have defaulted on that. We've yet to file the papers. I need to get those papers. I'm going to try to get that this week, get them filed up, because we're going after the governor here also. And any legislator, anybody who takes an oath and then starts using their political position as a platform to destroy our rights, our unalienable rights, to destroy common law, to destroy our Constitution, to ignore we the people, they need to leave office or they need to be indicted. That's their choice. And maybe we'll put it to them that way. You got 30 days to vacate or change your position. And if not, guess what, fella? You're indicted. Maybe that's the way we'll approach it this Thursday. But I'll look into that and I'll bring that up on Thursday. Okay, so we have Rudy Giuliani coming up. And that, like I said, that's going to be probably, I don't know how long his podcast is going to take to get up there. He said a couple of weeks. But I anticipated him doing it every day, 5 days a week, for maybe 2 weeks, and that's 10. But I don't know what a couple of weeks are. So whenever that is, whenever he's finished with that, we will be coming together quite quickly after that. So keep up to date on those videos. If you are going to participate in this. And pharmaceutical, okay, abrogation of law to land. We've already written a paper to them about that, the New York SAFE Act, the judiciary lawsuit, which continues. We need everyone to get involved. Anybody who can assist us in any way or getting onto any talk shows to get the word out, radio programs, so on, get a hold of Jan. He's the national leader. You can find him at NationalLibertyAlliance.org under our directory. Click on directory and you'll find his name and email and phone number up towards the top. We need everyone to get involved in this thing, okay? I guess that's all I have for announcements. So we're going to move forward. We'll go over. Gerard, are you going to take the board? Are you here? Hello, Gerard.
Yeah, let me just get off my speakers and on my headset.
Yeah, I'm going to move over to Brent, so you got some time.
Okay.
All right, Brent, are you here? Can you unmute yourself there?
I think I just did.
You just did. Okay. All right, this is Brent Winters. He's the author of quite a few books, one of them being The Excellence of the Common Law. Brent Winter's website is commonlawyer.com. He's a common lawyer, and he's going to teach us something. Brent, you got the mic. Thank you.
And thank you. My comments are my own, and then no one else takes responsibility for them but me. And I like to say there are only two kind of lawyers in the world, only two. There are common lawyers and civil lawyers. Common lawyers are not that common, and civil lawyers are uncivil, as we understand the word civil. What is a common lawyer? A common lawyer is a lawyer that lives in a common law country. We are a common law country. There are only about five. All the rest of the world are under the civil law, the law of Justinian, the code of the Roman Empire in its various forms. Well, our country is not one of those countries. Fundamentally, the common law countries are the English-speaking world. The English-speaking world. Few in number by comparison, but powerful and prosperous compared to all other countries. Why is that? Well, it's because of our law. I was talking to a Russian recently, stayed in a hotel. The lady at the desk that checked me in was Russian. She had come here with her husband. Her husband was an American. She married him. She said, "I'm Russian." I said, "Funny thing about Russia, Russia has 1/6 of the land area of the entire world. More gold, more coal, more copper, more diamonds, more timber, more farmland than any country in the world. But yet they're not prosperous. They haven't been for the last 75 years or better. Of course, it's not that they aren't hardworking people, smart people, kind people. Russian people are decent people. I've been around them on quite a few occasions. And they're fascinating people, creative people. But I don't care who you are. You get yourself under the wrong, somehow you land or born under the law, wrong law. Well, you've got a different lawgiver. Different law, different lawgiver. And if that different lawgiver is not not the maker of heaven and earth, you're going to live in a rotten condition. That's the way it always works. Are all Americans worshippers of the true God? No, but traditionally, we've had a critical mass of people that acknowledge the true maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is, and his law is different. His law comes in two volumes, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. That's what our Declaration of 76 says, and it is correct. Phrases taken from men like John Locke. John Locke, who was a fan, he was an Englishman, but he was a fan of the Scottish Enlightenment. John Locke's teacher was John Owen, the most famous Puritan that ever lived. John Locke was a Puritan. John Locke, said Tom Jefferson, was one of the three greatest mortals that ever lived. Well, John Locke wasn't great himself, I don't suppose, any more than anybody else, but he was at the right place in the right time, and he had the right ambition to accept the idea that there are only two volumes of law, only two. And those are the right two, and there are no others, these and no others, and these and no more. The laws of nature, as Blackstone puts it, lex non scripta, not written. The laws of nature are the way things are and creation around us and the relationships between things and things and people and things and people and people. The relationship, the laws that govern those relationships. That's the laws of nature, and our common law is a significant slice of it. It's not written, so it's what we observe. Men observe the laws of nature. That's why I have no desire to ever step out in front of a speeding Greyhound bus. I understand the laws of nature, the laws of perpetual motion. I don't jump off of buildings out of second-story windows because I understand the laws of gravity. Those are the laws of nature, and they have to do with the nature of things, the relationship between us and horizontally, other men and men in government. Those are the laws of nature, our common law, and our common law courts make observations as cases arise of what that law is and how it runs. And those observations come out, of course, in a fundamental way in court opinions. That's why we call them opinions in our common law country. The decrees of government are not called opinions in other countries because they say, no, what men say is the law, if they're in the right position. The office sanctifies the man. The badge sanctifies the man. The gun sanctifies the man. That's the position of the Code of Justinian. That's not true in our common law country. Well, that's the first volume, unwritten. And the second volume is written. And in cases of misunderstanding between the two, the second volume is the final rule. Again, I'm quoting William Blackstone in his commentaries on, people call it the commentaries on the common law. The laws of nature are the unwritten lex non scripta law. That's the first volume. We'll call it a volume. The second volume is the law written. That's the Bible. The laws of nature's God and the laws of nature, unwritten, and the laws of nature's God, says our Declaration of 76, those are the phrases from the Scottish Enlightenment through men like John Locke. Things are bad. I didn't watch the Super Bowl, didn't give two hoots and a holler. They're not worried about what I do and how I'm doing today, and they're making millions. Why should I worry about them? Beef on the hoof. And they're willing to make money while transvestites promote. I just heard about it. I didn't see it, but people are telling me how terrible it all was. The halftime show and the perversion and the perverts, and that's the world we're living in. And they say that's all lawful. Well, it's time that we said, no, that's not lawful. We love our children. We don't want them to be persuaded into that madness of sodomy and lesbianism and the despair and the hardship that comes out of all that and the despair of life. So we repair to true law. We've been talking about the militia because it's been on our minds. Been on our minds because of what's happening in Virginia, in the Commonwealth of Virginia. They're trying to take all the guns. And there are four militia clauses of our Constitution. We talk about the Second Amendment. That's just one of four. That one, by the way, in order of the Constitution of the United States, is the fourth militia clause. And it is the foundation of the other three. The other three militia clauses grant, delegate duties to people in government. The Second Amendment, the last militia clause, is different in that it delegates nothing. It recognizes a duty that our Maker has bestowed upon each man directly, individually. It's part of who he is, a fundamental right. That's what we call a fundamental right, a right that doesn't come from government. Well, who's it come from then? Other men? No, it comes from God. That's why we call them fundamental. If rights come from men, they're not anything but but worthless permission in most cases. But duties arise out of law. Law comes from the only true lawgiver. And if you confine your ultimate lawgiver to we the people, you'll be as weak as we the people. How weak are we the people? Not only are they weak, every member of them is wound up and bound up in his own whims and difficulties. And putting a bunch of weak men together like that doesn't form anything but more weakness. It magnifies the problem. That's what it does. No, we the people is not the God of America. And to say that is to say that we're dumb enough to put ourselves in the hands of other men. That's what the people are, other men. And we're part of that. And whoever you take as your protector, ultimately, will be your master. And if it's not the Maker of heaven and earth, it will be your abuser. Whether it's we the people, well, that's what the Romans said. Romans said, the voice, vox, the voice of the people is the voice. Oh, they called it the voice of the demos. That's where we get the word democracy. What does that mean? Well, it couldn't mean anything but the majority. That's all it could mean. Doesn't amount to pinch of nothing. Again, well, a dangerous. It amounts to something very dangerous. But we don't depend upon that. We're a government of law, not of men. And law comes from the true lawgiver. Well, this is the pursuant to the second the second militia clause of our Constitution. And I remember years ago learning about, I used to hear that song by Bob Wills, deep within my heart lies a melody, a song of old San Antone, where in dreams I live with a memory beneath the stars all alone. And a beautiful love song about a man in Texas who met a pretty girl near the Alamo one warm night, fell in love. Well, he wrote that song because he had just finished cutting a record, and the record company said, look, we've got 4 or 5 more minutes left on this cut we could put on here. You got anything else you could sing? He said, no, I don't. They said, well, we can't make a record unless you got something else. We got to finish this up. So he sat down outside in a little room, got a pencil and a piece of paper, and 15 minutes later, he had the words of that song. That's the way good things happen sometimes. And that song became his most famous song. Magna Carta, by the way, was written that way. Magna Carta, Stephen Langton. all of his learning, all of his life, fell together rapidly while the King of England tried to muster an army and come after the landholders. The landholders retaliated, mustered an army, and surrounded him. And the need then arose rapidly for Magna Carta to be written so they'd give something to John to sign. Because they wanted to get him on paper. And they had him surrounded. And they had their swords at his throat. And he whipped that document out, slick as a hickory whistle in a twinkling of an eye. And when you read it, you realize it's not that organized. Why he wrote it in a hurry. The Declaration of 76 was a little better written, but it was written and signed while the signers had the reek of gunpowder in their noses. Men were killing each other as they signed. Same thing happened with the Covenanters when they signed the Scottish Covenants of the 1630s. It was a tough time. Well, I wrote a pattern of state militia statute. I wasn't under that. Well, yeah, I was. I won't tell you the whole story. I was in a pretty bad way, frankly. And I had to put a lot of things out of my mind to maintain my sanity, my emotional stability, put it that way. And I did. I wrote several books during that time. And this is one of them. And at the end, I put this model state militia statute. And it seemed like everything that I'd learned for the past three decades or more just fell together, and I wrote it. Didn't take that long. Now, I wrote it pretty quick, but I had to go back, of course, and clean it up. But it fell out of my mind and down into my pen, and I put it down. Then I had to get the bugs out of it, but I want to read it to you. I had read the preamble to it before. I present this as a possibility for somebody to give to the state legislature so he may take it, work through it, and use it as a pattern in his own state. This militia statute is pursuant to the four militia clauses of the United States Constitution, which, of course, like the rest of our Constitution, it being a common law document, a brief of common law government, nothing new. They didn't make that stuff up. They were just trying to establish what the machinery they had in place already as a common law country. And the militia, it was a large and is a large part of that still. Here's the first provision of this statute. I don't profess this to be inspired at all. That's not the point, no. But it is my observation, as the common law is, my observation of the way things are and they will not change, and the way things ought to be. The militia of this state includes all males between ages of 20 and 45. Dwelling within its boundaries, having intent to dwell within this state for the indefinite future, and able-bodied to carry and fire the weapon this state's legislature designates. The militia of this state does not include females. Now, keep in mind, while I was writing this, I'm informing, doing my best to inform these words with the understanding I have from our common law, because our Constitution and its four militia clauses, explain nothing. And nothing. It's not intended to explain. It's intended to get it down in compact draft, as the Supreme Court said years ago. Our Constitution did that. And it is informed by our common law. It is not possible to put it into motion without our common law being the animating spirit that makes it stand up and walk on all fours. Otherwise, it's nothing more than a dispirited skeleton of words. Number two of the militia statute, militia duty in this state shall remain voluntary, not mandatory. Now, at common law, the militia is mandatory, but I said this because I'm trying to think of a way to get the militia going again. But it ought to say mandatory if you're going to follow the law. Precisely. But things aren't perfect, so I said, let's start out with what is voluntary. And then I say, unless until such time as this state's legislature acts to make militia duty mandatory for all able-bodied militia members. Able-bodied militia members. You know, you don't have to volunteer to be a militiaman. You are a militiaman. You're born in that condition. And when you reach age 20, there you are. Whether you understand it or not, or whether you know it or not. Why? Because God said so. That's why. You say, he said? I mean, God said that a militiaman is a militiaman at age 20? And the answer to that is yes, that's true. And we can go to the Laws of Nature's God, that second volume written, and show that in spades, expressly, over and over again. And in this book about the militia, I go through that, go through the Bible and its provisions, primarily in the book of Numbers, its provisions about the militia. Provision number three, any man fulfilling the requirements of paragraph one above, that's the one that says what a militiaman is between the ages of 20 and 45, may present himself as available for militia duty by reporting to a supervisor of the township wherein he resides at the place and during the time said supervisor or supervisors designate. It's a local question. Militia duty always is. You say, where are you getting this stuff? Well, listen. People say, oh, our common law dates back to Magna Carta. It does, but it dates back a lot further than that. Magna Carta tried to do, the framers of Magna Carta, Stephen Langton, tried to do with Magna Carta what those that drafted the Constitution of the United States tried to do. What's that? Reestablish something that had been lost. They weren't making it up, as I said a while ago. They were trying to reestablish what had been lost. Magna Carta tried to reestablish our common law as it occurred before the Norman invasion of 1066 among the Anglo-Saxons and the Anglo-Danes. They had a stronger sense of personal property rights. And Magna Carta was an attempt to apply those first principles to present-day circumstances. Our Constitution of the United States is an attempt to apply those same principles to present-day circumstances. Justice James Wilson, United States Supreme Court, he was on the first panel of the United States Supreme Court. He said this. He said that our Constitution did not attempt to establish the common law as it stood in that day as much as it attempted to reestablish the common law as it stood before the Norman Conquest. And when I talk about the common law, I'm not talking about some detailed thing about minutiae. No, I'm talking about the grand principles that govern everything. Govern everything. Like what? Like separation of powers. That only occurs in common law countries. Co-equal powers. That only occurs in common law countries. Rights do not come from the decrees of government. That only occurs in common law countries. We're the only ones that even have notions of such things. But what amazes me, discourages me, is that I hear men that are my age that really do have the idea that, for instance, the Second Amendment grants rights to people to keep and bear arms. It doesn't. It recognizes this duty that God has given men of self-protection of themselves, their families, their neighbors, their territory, their country, their land, against enemies, foreign and domestic. And that's the way the ancient common law expressed the duty of the militiaman to protect against enemies foreign. That means armed defense and domestic. That means willingness to serve on the jury. There are two duties of government, fundamentally, no more. One is justice, that means the courts, jury duty, and the other one's armed defense. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. That's why the jury is so important. Let's go to paragraph 4. Any man choosing to so report for militia duty shall then provide in writing to the township supervisor his name, address, and other contact information in order to enable quick response to summons, any personal skills useful for militia duty, and his signature of acceptance that he will be placed upon his township's role of this state's militia. Now, common law before the Norman Conquest, and I'm thinking specifically the last 50 years of the 9th century, that would have been 850 to 899, that was the life of the man that the English people call King Alfred the Great. They don't call anybody great but Alfred. You know, they're very reserved in their flowery speech about glorifying people. It's their culture. Most of their names and subnames for their sovereigns, their kings and queens, are derogatory, like John Lackland, you know. But with Alfred, or Bloody Mary, there's another one, Bloody Mary. What a rotten old woman she came to be. But Alfred was great. And when you read about the life of Alfred, you realize it wasn't that he was great because he was great. He was a man that was struck with a whole lot of problems, including what people believe had to be epilepsy. He was in bad shape in a lot of ways. He had a lot of other problems. He died about age 49. Didn't live that long. He suffered terrible military defeats, and he rallied and came back and won against the Vikings, the Danes. But he himself had a thirst, according to his secretary, his scribe, a Welshman by the name of Asher. He had a thirst for the Bible, and he ordered it to be translated. Matter of fact, they couldn't translate it until until English was put to writing. In those days, Anglo-Saxon wasn't in a written form. So him and his Welsh scribe, his secretary Asher, took the Latin letters and applied them to English, and we've been using them ever since. But he did that so that he could put the Bible into the native tongue of his own people, and they could read it and understand the will of the true lawgiver. That's significant. And he did that. That's what drove him. That's why he was great. And you ought to read his confessions. You ought to read his writings. He wrote in English after that. It's incredible. Incredible. No, it's believable. No, it almost isn't believable, some of the things he said, and the earthy way that he says them. You can buy those. They're in two volumes, paperback. I get them down and try to decipher through them once in a while. Well, as I wrote this, I'm having the common law in mind in front of me, trying to inform what the Constitution's clauses say, and then put it in the form of a statute. I said this, what I'm reading to you is pursuant to the militia clauses, because the Constitution of the United States says that the state legislature of your state is duty-bound to provide a militia statute. That's what the clause boils down to. This is not lawlessness, this militia business. You are a militiaman, and as such, you have a duty. What is it? To keep and bear arms. What about the other people that are involved with the militia? The state government, the president, the governor of your state, the Congress of the United States, all of those are specifically given duties. Our Constitution delegates duties to them, and they've ignored those duties for 175 years. Isn't it funny? We say it over and over again. It creates outrage. People take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. They don't know squat from straight up about the Constitution, 99% of them, and they don't even care to. It's not on their radar. Nobody ever taught it to them. They're not paying attention to it. They're like most Christian folk. Most Christian folk will tell, oh, I believe the Bible. Can they recite the 66 books in order? Doubt it. Does that mean that they know the Bible? No, but it means that maybe they have an interest in it. They're trying to figure out what it is, get the flow of it, but they're not doing that any more than the Constitution. The Constitution is not the final rule of faith and practice for Americans. The final rule of faith and practice and life for Americans is the Bible, the Word of God written, breathed as the Bible says, breathed from the very breath of God, recorded. A penman recorded it. Not as autotoms, but their personalities and their vocabulary preserved in the superintendence of the Spirit superintended their writing of the Bible. God's will, His law. Each militiaman, verse 5, no, we're not in verses, we're not in the Bible, we're in the militia statute, section 5, each militiaman of this state, whether officer or non-officer, upon being enrolled, shall say the following upon his oath or solemn affirmation. Now, let me read this oath. And then I'll go back and make a couple of comments about solemn affirmation. Here's the oath that our Constitution of the United States says every office holder in state and federal government must take. Every office holder. Why? Well, it's that important. That's why. And the oath is designed to awaken a man's sensibilities. That's what is, and his duty, to stop and be solemn. The oath, watch me close, the oath does not add any duty to anybody. We all have this duty to start with, every person, man or woman. But the oath is designed to awaken the conscience. It doesn't bind you to any new duty, as one fellow says, but it further binds you to a duty you already have. Here it goes. It says this. This is what the oath says. I will support and defend the Constitution of this state and of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Remember that phrase, a common law, means I'm willing to take up arms, that's defense, foreign, and domestic enemies, that means I'm willing to serve on the jury to defend the law of the land, our common law. That's what the law of the land is, our common law. I'm willing to defend the law of the land, which defends the land, and I'm willing to defend the land by force of arms. That's what that means. Let me continue reading this oath. And upon being duly called and mustered into actual service of this state, I will obey all lawful orders of the governor of this state and of the officers placed over me, and upon being duly called and mustered into actual service of the United States, I will obey all lawful orders of the President of the United States and of the officers placed over me. Now notice in both instances, swearing that you will obey all orders. Is that what it says? No, that's not what it says. It says you're swearing to obey all, what's this word? Lawful orders. Your duty is to obey lawful orders of government. That's always been the duty of a Christian man. Indeed, it's always been the duty of every man. Lawful orders, and it's up to you. Tough job. God has given you the duty of discernment. It's no small duty. You've got to decide what orders are lawful and what are not. And nobody can do it for you. And you need to do that and learn to do it. We all do, as it says in Hebrews chapter 5. We need to do that every day of our lives. Because if we don't exercise, the writer to the Hebrews says, if we don't exercise that discernment, then our discernment, like the muscles on our body, will atrophy, they'll get weak. That's the analogy he uses. So we must start right away. Oh, you're going to make the wrong choices. I am too. I still do. But I got to keep it buffed up. I got to keep it sharp. I've got to make decisions. You know, one of the things the evil empire wants to do to you is take away your ability to discern right from wrong. How do you do that? Take away the decisions you have to make. That's how they do it. The useful idiots of the evil empire. It's all around you, taking away your choice, personal choice, a freedom, a duty to make choices every day. Prison is designed. Prisons are unlawful. Well, there are other ways to deal with that, better ways, easier ways. Prisoners would like it better. If you don't believe it, ask any prisoner. Would you rather serve a year in jail or take 39 lashes with a cat and nine tails? I've asked hundreds of men that question in prison. The answer is always the same. I'd rather take 30 lashes with a set of cat and nine tails. Why? Well, because prison is loss of liberty. And liberty means you lose your life and your property. Those three stand together, life, liberty, and property. They stand and fall together. You lose one, you lose the other two. They'd rather. And these are men that have been to prison and know the difference. If you haven't been to prison, you don't really know the difference. But listen to those that have, because as men, we can learn from the experiences of others. We're not like the cat. You know, the cat can watch another cat set on a hot stove lid and he won't learn the lesson. He'll go sit on it too. But we can read the experiences of others. We can hear the stories of others. We can learn. Let's do that. That's what prison is, just as an example. And when you go to prison, you don't get to choose what you eat, when you eat, or what clothes to wear. Did you stop to think? Every day of your life, you decide which socks to put on. Unless, of course, you're from the hills of Arkansas or someplace. I say that with fondness. I got a lot of friends down there. I grew up like that. Well, I shouldn't say that. I got a lot of family at home that grew up like that. I grew up like that quite a bit myself. But decisions are the mark of a free man. the ability, the freedom to choose. And when you're a part of the evil empire, you're part of that martial order of the evil empire. They want to take away every choice you can make. I talked to a fellow recently. He married a girl whose mother was from Ireland. I got to talking to them both. They're friends. He's a mining engineer, by the way. I got to talking to them both, and she was showing me. I was at their house. They were serving supper, showing me what kind of butter she uses. I say, why do you use that butter? And I'll tell you what the name of it was. You can buy it in the store. The name of it is, shucks, it's not coming to me. It's the best butter you can buy at Walmart or any other grocery store, and most of them have it. It's from Ireland, and it's good butter. And you don't have to pay that much for it, comparatively, really. Oh, I wish I could think the name of it, but she used it. And I said, why do you use that? She told me why she used it. I said, I do too. I buy it too. Kerrygold, I believe. No, Kerrygold. Kerrygold is the name of the butter. Oh, Kerrygold. Yeah, I just got a message from a trusted listener here and found out that her sister lives over in Ireland, or her brother, I don't know who it was, somebody in the family, and they have a dairy farm, and they provide butter for this company. It's good butter. It's clean butter. It's free of hormones and all that. And she said she was talking to some of her relatives, and over in Ireland, they're thinking about deregulating the dairy industry. And she said that her relatives are panicked, and they're worried. I said, what are they worried about? Well, they're worried that they won't have anybody to tell them what to do. I said, you're joking. No, she said, I'm not joking. They don't know what to do. Listen, I know that's true. I believe it. I've seen people, men, come out of prison that did and came out, but they threw them out. They didn't really want to leave. They'd been there for 10, 20 years, and it scared them to death to come out. They were like the Israelites down in Egypt in bondage. They didn't want to leave. God had to drag them out, and their heels were in the sand, and that's the way it is when a person gets accustomed to somebody else substituting his will for yours. Independence of mind. Well, we're back to the oath. Independence of discernment, of decision. And in no event, I have written in here, shall any other oath be required of any militiaman of this state. That's the oath. And so on oath or affirmation, I'll end with this. Oath or affirmation. Why do I say oath or affirmation? I say oath or affirmation for the same reason the Constitution of the United States gives a person a choice. Why is that? Well, there are a lot of people in Christendom who believe in all of their hearts, their heart of hearts, that we are to never take oaths, and they believe that Jesus Christ commands us to not take oaths. And in the colonies, the largest colony, population-wise, at the beginning of our country, when our Constitution was emplaced, the largest colony, population-wise, was Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania was filled with Quakers. Quakers founded that state as a colony. John Fox was the founder of the Quaker movement in England. They called him Quakers because people said Fox, they wouldn't let him preach in the churches, but when he preached out in the open fields, they said he quaked. I don't know that that's true, but Quakers don't believe that. They believe the Bible says we're not to take oaths, and they didn't want to disenfranchise the Quakers from political life, and that's why they said that. And that's why I say it here, not because I don't want to disenfranchise Quakers. I say it because I don't want to disenfranchise a lot of Christian folk, who are my friends even, many of them, who take a different position than I do. I believe that the oath is that Jesus Christ, when he said what he said, that's taken wrongly. I have good reasons. If you want to know why I believe that, you can get the winterized version of the Bible, and I have a long note on that passage, and you can read it. But it's not my position that that's the case. But in deference to other people who are sincere and learned, I include that the possibility of affirmation outside of taking an oath. Gerard or John, if you're there, I'll yield up my time. And oh, I've had a lot. Thank you so much again for allowing me a few words. Gerard is looking for the button. I know Gerard.
I said, let me get my headset on so you know I can cancel the background noise here. Okay. Okay. Thank you, Brent. That was good. So we're going to go to questions and answers now. I believe that's where we're at. And the first victim looks like Heather Lee from Michigan, is it? Go ahead, Heather Lee. You've been unmuted.
I'm from Michigan, Northern Michigan. I have a question concerning, actually, I just want to make a comment. That was just excellent. Your voice is excellent, and your commentaries are excellent, and I thoroughly enjoy them. My question being, I have a friend who has a case, and I've been working on it this last week with her. If you had to travel to the other side of the state to help her with it. It is a case of past tense, however, it is in the present, in as much as it's ongoing. Her and her husband worked for the federal government as a sharpshooter. Unfortunately, he knew too much, and they, as he was trying to retire, cut the cord. The government, set both him and her up, husband and wife, and framed them and then incarcerated them. Falsely accused them of they were helping this young girl, and both very Christian people. And the girl was a very troubled young lady, and in her early teens, she was related to a, I believe, a judge. If not, I'm trying to see who it was. She was related to someone in power in this state. Mm-hmm. And they used her false witness to frame them for sexual abuse and just absurdities with this young lady when they went out of their way to help her. And he died eventually. He was incarcerated in federal prison. They did several things to him, and when he was released, they hit him with a car. Okay, the wife, who is still alive, and my friend, who is a wonderful prayer warrior, she tried to get to him. They separated the husband and wife. They went from Georgia to Kentucky with the hearing and incarceration, several just abominable trespasses of their rights, just abominable. And she ended up in Michigan, and even as she came from Kentucky, was sentenced in Kentucky and was incarcerated there, then she was released on probation. She went to Michigan, and Michigan added an extra 5 to the incarceration to the probation, even though it was in the sentence that wasn't supposed to be.
That's unlawful. They can't. They're not supposed to be able to add to a sentence.
I know that, and so it's on it goes. So here she is. Her phones are monitored. Her emails are monitored. And she is in hibernation, if you will, in her little house. She's not allowed to minister to children. She's not allowed to go near anything to do with children. She's restricted here, there, and yon with these falsifications. And So she's still under the thumb of this whole thing. And I am trying to put a case together of, I believe, habeas corpus, because she's still under probation. And she, I believe that they intend on doing this until such time as, I don't know, the sentence continues, and it's just grueling, and it, and I'm incensed.
Yeah, I wouldn't believe that, you know, a habeas corpus is proper in this instance. So how many years is this going on now?
Let's see.
Approximately.
I'd say 20 years.
20 years.
I'm trying to find the
so she's getting up there in age then, if it's been going on
20
years.
Oh, yeah, she's almost 70, and she's still
in
her
first season. Oh, my goodness.
And yeah, I've just had enough.
Yeah, I would say that she should do a habeas corpus as soon as possible. And, you know, just her whole situation, you know, maybe yeah, she can even get some special consideration because of this baloney that's gone on. Look, there's been a lot of regime change in 20 years, too, because the guys that were hiding 20 years ago, they're not around anymore, most of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of them are, but, you know. This is
something we could bring to the president, too. There is a process.
That's where I was going, because it's like, this is cruel and unusual. This is extraordinary.
Yeah, and he gets involved in this kind of a thing. This is a national concern.
She worked for the Navy, by the way, too. So she was, you know, on their radar at one time. And even her license, she was an RN.
Can you do an affidavit?
I'm working with Jim, and I brought it before you because
look at with this particular affidavit, you can go longer than a couple of pages. You know, put the whole story down. It sounds like it's a long story that needs to be told. But again, we got to be careful not to put things in there that's not necessary, and we will definitely work with you on this one. One of the first things I would do is bring it. You know, I think you should do a habeas corpus. Maybe that's the first thing to do is a habeas corpus, but prepare the paperwork to file with the president at the same time with a copy of the habeas corpus.
Yes, I agree. This is one of the, under their skirt things that they do to their people that they don't want information brought out on, and to silence people. And they certainly did her husband. And it's just a crying shame, and just makes you incredulous against such atrocities that they have committed against this precious couple. And I have had her, I worked with her last week. It was very difficult for her. She thought she burned all the papers because it was so traumatic. And thank God, praise his name, that we miraculously found some of the papers that, calling those things that are not as though they were. And so she has the story, she's got the name, and I brought her to that, and now she's writing in remembrance, and she's a good writer, and she's writing the story. So we're already after this. So with the affidavit, that will allow the story to be told, condensed, to the point, and that's what I thought initially, the habeas corpus to put this in. I already have her statement.
Have you talked with Francine?
No.
Okay, when you talk to Jim, have him connect you with Francine, because I think Francine should get involved in helping with your affidavit on this one. And again, we'll make an exception of length on this. So whatever it takes to get the story in there, but again, she'll help you to make sure we don't put things in there that aren't necessary. You know, one of the key things you don't want to put in there, you don't want to talk about they violated some unalienable right. You don't want to talk about they broke some law and get into that. You don't want to get into details that take you away from the facts. It's only the facts. You know, what was a dragnet? I don't know. Well, many people in here probably remember dragnet. And the first thing they always say, just the facts, ma'am, only the facts. That's all we want. We don't want no more than the facts. Because as far as the legal position on this and you know, putting things together in a proper way, we'll do that in a proper paper to file with it.
Excellent. That's what I've had her do. Find the files, put the facts down, put the names down. I told her how these forms are being made out. I'm working with Jim on them and helping him. And I went through the whole thing to help her. She's quite an intelligent woman. And so we've already begun on all of this. And like I said, I had the condensed statement for a habeas corpus for the intake for Jim. For the intake, I had just a paragraph. I said, okay, we're going to just boil this baby right down, and we did. So I came back with that. And so that's all ready to go. I can set up an intake for her. And,
all right. Well, you know, again, let's. Once you get all that done, we'll have a private conversation with you, maybe, and with her if she wants, and we'll just take it from there. But again, tell Jim, and I'm sure Jim's listening in right now anyway. So he should take this to Francine for the purpose of writing the affidavit, because she's has the background and experience to assist you in this kind of a thing. You know, most of what we worked out with Jim is to keep affidavits very narrow, very short. And we want this to be narrow and short and on point, because once you get off point, then you get the, you know, all of a sudden you get all this stuff in there and you get lost in what really this is all about.
Yeah,
so you want to stay on facts.
Yeah.
But again, you know, Jim can assist you with Francine, but Francine, I think, needs to be involved in this. Okay?
Okay.
And then we can discuss things further after we do that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Heather Lee. Next up is Steve from Wisconsin, it looks like.
Yeah, I'm Steve from Wisconsin.
How are you doing?
Not bad. Say, I guess I've filed some of these petitions to joinder and those kind of things, but... One thing that's bothered me, I guess, is back in 2015, I filed a federal case with the common law statements, you know, court record.
Mm-hmm.
And this judge was messing with me, and the clerk wouldn't give me the subpoenas. And finally, then I did kind of like a mandamus, and the judge filed some paper and closed the case. And I was wondering if there was a way to do the petition to joinder against him closing my case, seeing as it was a common law case.
Well, yeah, I don't see why we couldn't assist you on that. And, you know, the key thing, look at these judges. Either they're evil or dumb, and there's a good mixture of both in the soup there, so to speak. Was it state or federal? This sounds like it's state.
This was federal.
It was federal. Oh, okay. Well, then you got evil here, because the federal judge knows. You see, they're counting on you not knowing what to do, and they become so, conditioned. Because very rarely, if they get a pushback, they're able to push them back down, and then they get people quitting. And that has been consistent. And maybe a judge has been there 10, 15, 20 years, and every time he pushes back against the people, then they're able to come back and be relentless and eventually get it to the point where the judge starts to get nervous. That is a rare thing. And so they get conditioned to this, and they get used to just, you know, just doing the wrong thing, the evil thing all the time. We can do something with you, you know, I guess you're in touch with Jim at this point, talking with him about it, and see what you can do about bringing the paperwork together.
Well, I haven't talked with him about the federal case, because I think he kind of gave me the impression that you guys were always concerned that there was some statutory stuff kind of mixed in.
Well, look at when did you work for the government?
No. Well, okay. I was a teacher.
Yeah, well, you didn't work
years ago, but
look, it becomes a problem if you were employed by the government or you're in commercial activities that are under the control legislation. Okay, as long as you're outside of those two issues, then they have no authority over you. And the moment you walked into that court, you were in jurisdictions unknown. They were operating under Rule 2. You said it was only about 10, 15 years ago or 5 years. How long ago was it?
Well, it was 5 years ago.
Okay, so 5 years ago. Well, within the time period. They're operating under Rule 2, and Rule 2 is subversion against the United States of America. It's subversion against our Constitution. We, the people, everything we are, everything that we believe, it's subversion against that. And he is pushing that. He knows that's wrong, by the way. But he's pushing that anyway. He's following the status quo, and he's doing what he needs to do to fulfill, you know, the people above them, what their desires are, not what the justice desire of justice is. And so the moment you walked into that courtroom and he denied you a court of record, then that's it. You're in jurisdictions unknown. You didn't get due process. And you can write a good wherefore clause that will give you a certain, what would I call it? I guess restitution. You'll get restitution just for the violating of your rights. And then, of course, what are the damages? Not that we would pursue that for you, but you can make that point and we can put it into the paperwork. So, but, there is no statute of limitations whatsoever. You know, the only thing that prevents a case in common law to go forward is the fact that maybe the case is so old that none of the witnesses are still alive and it just can't be prosecuted or from either side. And so you can't go forward. Or, you know, the documents have been lost and they're not there. You know, so if you don't have the proof, then that prevents the case from going forward. Statutes set forth limitations on various things. And even though the documents and the witnesses may still be available, it's 2 years has passed or 10 years has passed, you can't go no forward. Well, that's not just. For every injury, there must be a remedy. And so you have a right to go and to take care of that remedy any time. As soon as you could discover that you've been really wrong 10 years after the whole thing is all over and you're moving in a different direction, and you can discover, wow, you know, I was really assaulted pretty bad and they didn't have the right to do that. They didn't give me my due process. They violated my unalienable rights in numerous ways and places. You can go forward. As long as you have the witnesses and the documentation to prove your case, you can have a case. And you have a right to be heard. Okay? You have that right. So, anyway, you can go forward.
Yeah, I had, 99 exhibits, and, you know, I was, and I still have them. The thing is, these people are still around. I mean, they're still messing with other people, I'm sure. But the damages that have been caused now are basically my house and my income. You know,
Have you lost your house over this, or are you in a process?
Well, it was close. I had to come up with some money on one of the houses. The other house, I'm not sure. I inherited the house from my parents. So it's not like I'm some rich person. It's just that it was a family house.
All right, well, look, it worked things out with Jim, and it's something you can proceed on.
All right.
Okay.
The other question, I finished all of the civics and government by consent. I've done the militia course. I did put in for the grand jury thing some time ago, but I wasn't sure what else I was supposed to do.
You mean you put in to become an administrator for the grand jury?
I believe so, yeah. I probably
okay, yeah, if you check the button and you got through the courses, that's good, and you've gone through the major courses, which, of course, is the civics course, and the most important is the government by consent course, because that's the most in-depth and detail, but both courses are so important because the civics course really gives you a good understanding of how we got here.
You know,
we have a lot of documentaries concerning that, and we've got, like, I forget what it is, 15 lectures or so, roughly, maybe 20, I don't remember, I think the guy's name is James Wood, professor of history, American history, and he is really, really good. He gets down to the nuts and the bolts, and he lays it out pretty clear what the intentions were and the true history of our nation. So, you know, that was it's a really eye-opening course. We also have Bill Thornton in there. Although Bill Thornton thinks that, you know, he's the king of the court, and he's not.
Oh, yeah.
You know, God is the king of the court. But we, the people, represent God in that court when we come in. If we're coming in to seek assistance from the federal government, for instance, okay, we are representing the king of the court when we're telling the federal government, we're going into the federal courts and saying, hey, look, we're being abused down in the courts down here. We need your assistance. We want you to send down a written mandamus to command them to obey the law and give us due process. There's nothing to think about. There's nothing to decide for that judge. You made the accusation by affidavit. You're being abused and not getting due process. It is his duty to write a writ mandamus and send it down to that court and order them to cease and desist or provide a court that can give him due process. Of course, they can't provide a court to give due process because they don't even know what that means, and therefore they'll have to cease and desist. And if you go improperly, you can also put in a wherefore clause that you're demanding, restitution for the assault upon your unalienable rights and deprivation of those rights, and it's X amount of dollars for each incident. I usually like $1,000 in face value of silver. That's my preference, and then that's what you ask for each each injury on that. But you can push this forward. It's up to you. But the federal court definitely has a duty not to decide, okay, I'm going to make a decision. No, forget that. Right now and then, sign it. I bring my papers in, ready for them to sign. Why can't you sign it, Your Honor? There's nothing to decide here. Okay, there's nothing to think about. Sworn affidavit. I swear that they injured me. You have to believe that. I'm going to be prosecuted if that's a false statement, so you don't have to worry about that. That's a sworn statement. They're not giving me due process, and this is how I showed you. They're not giving me access into a court of record. Nothing else to talk about. So they have that duty. The United States Supreme Court, the federal district courts underneath that United States District Court has that duty to perform that duty. The only other, they can't hear a case, but they definitely can hear that kind of an issue because that's what it is. Anything that falls under the umbrella of the Constitution, that's how the Constitution is written up. Anything underneath the Constitution, they have the judicial powers and authorities under it. And it detailed exactly what kind of cases, but clearly a case against anything in the Bill of Rights puts you right in the game there. Okay.
All right. So I should just get a hold of Jim again then, and
yeah, start if you want to do it. Start the process with Jim.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gerard.
And also, you might want to take the militia course. That's another course, especially anybody become an administrator. They should take all our courses.
No, I finished them all.
The militia course, too?
Yep.
Oh, well, you're quick. We just got that up a couple of weeks. That was very good. Okay. All right. And if you want to get involved in assistance, we need leadership on all levels. We need it on the county level, state level, and a national level. So if you want to participate, get a hold of Jan. You'll find him. Jim will give you his information.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Hey, Jan. Yeah, go ahead.
I've got several questions that were emailed in that we should probably run.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Shoot. Don't let them get away.
Okay. We'll start.
Any announcements before we go to there? I forgot about announcements, too, didn't I?
The judge, court, and district attorney have received the amicus the day of trial. I brought it to the court's attention on the record. They ignored the motion and proceeded in bad behavior. I was found guilty in a quasi nisi prius court with a stacked jury. I was forced to start signing up for probation. My sentencing is March 19th. What are the motions and actions to take on the record in this 28-day time period? I found guilty on the 22nd of January, sentencing on the 19th of March. How do
with the amicus curiae, once they ignored it, there's no longer need to wait any 30 days. Now that case should be moved into federal court for cause. You get a hold of Jim, and Jim should be able to take this process to the next, moving it into federal court for cause. And we have to give them 30 days. But What was the dates that they're going to be for the hearing for decision?
Well, the sentencing was 19 March. The hearing was January 22nd.
Okay, so we'll figure out as soon as we can get the paper movement. We may only give them 10 days or 15 days because we want to get in there before the sentencing takes place. We want to make this absolutely clear that there is a penalty to be paid for people who put up fake courts and run jurisdictions unknown and improperly and unlawfully incarcerate people and so on and so forth. So we want to get that message in as soon as possible. So, Jim, if you're listening, watch for this case to come back to you to push this and maybe discuss very specifically with me. We'll go through the dates when we're ready to make this move to make sure we get it within that time period. So this is a case where we're not going to give them 30 days. All right. Next question.
Okay, next question. Does standing in court when a judge, magistrate, and or clerk of court masquerading as a judge enters a courtroom grant jurisdiction?
Well, I can't see how it would grant jurisdiction. I never thought about, standing in court when a judge comes in as something for respect, maybe. I don't know. I have to think about something like that. You know, when the president walks on stage, everybody doesn't get up and stand. And he's a pretty high figure in government, and he represents our entire nation. He is an individual who represents the courts. I don't think when they tell you all stand and rise for whatever, you don't want to cause problems. Just stand and rise and sit down. Don't worry about it too much. But as far as being right or wrong, it's something that I never really thought about. Respect should be given to the court, and even though they're a tyrant up on the court, up on that little seedy ass with his hammer, even though he's being a tyrant, I kind of agree with the thinking of Brent brought up in the past that you don't want to do anything while he's in that position. Have respect for the position. Maybe not for him. He's in bad behavior. He needs to be in jail, in my opinion. So when he leaves the courtroom, that's when things could take place. He could be arrested or whatever the case may be. I definitely wouldn't want to, do anything that would be disrespectful inside the courtroom. So it doesn't give him that. Look, when I went down the first time I went into the federal court to fight these people, and I didn't go past, what do they call that, Gerard, that gate there? The bar. Go past, they call it the bar. It represents, I was listening too much of that crap, man on the land stuff. No, that doesn't mean anything. It's some kind of a secret thing. I'm entering his ship. That's a bunch of BS. That's all fraud, by the way. And that's what I would tell them to be. You want to bring that up? Go ahead, bring it up. We'll talk about fraud now.
I don't know. I felt seasick after you did that. No.
Yeah, I know. So I would not worry about crossing the bar. I wouldn't worry about all the different rituals. Who could care less? I make the point clear in the beginning of all my papers, that anything going down that road is nothing but fraud. And we're not going to acknowledge anything by that. And remember, they say, oh, you got a contract, and you did this or you did that. You adhere to a contract and an agreement. Well, a contract or an agreement requires the meeting of two minds or more, two or more minds, meeting of minds. There's no meeting of minds. They didn't. That's all fraud. It's all secret stuff. That's priestly stuff, as Jefferson spoke about it. So anyway, no worries. Next.
Okay, I have a friend that they are garnishing his paycheck because of him not filing his taxes at the end of the year. He works for Cat Bus System. He's a Cat Bus driver. What can he do to stop the garnishment of wages from his paycheck?
Well, join our case is about the only thing really that's going to get you anywhere. You can do, it depends on, it depends on who's removing it. If, let's say you're on Social Security and they're removing it from your Social Security, then you can go up against the Department of Social Security, the agency there, and the person responsible for that. And you'll find signatures somewhere, but nevertheless, you go after the commissioner and the underlings. And you could do a paper to them, a notice and demand, at the same time a notice demand to the IRS, demanding the fact that you didn't get due process, you don't fall under the requirement of having to do anything with these people, And we explained that in our case. You should go up and read that case because it'll enlighten you into a great understanding of what they're really doing and how they're doing it. And you can find that, of course, up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. And if you go underneath the grand jury, highlight the grand jury, come down indictment consideration on 2620, which is Thursday. Anybody that wants to participate as a grand jury to make a vote for indictments, we're having that at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this Thursday. But you do have to get up here and read the two cases. They both have the same evidence. So, you know, it's an IRS writ quo wanto draft, 16 pages with all the evidence below it. But if you read that paper, you'll get to understand what powers and authorities they don't have, because they don't have any. And you can start making positions. But I would do a notice and demand, make it clear to them what your intentions are. You need to study that on how to do a notice and demand. There's 8 points to be met. You can learn about that on our website, and you should learn about these other things that in this particular case. If you join us, of course, you can also add this case to be delivered to them, and their names will be put on the header as a defendant. So anybody who joins the case, all these agents, even if it's a, you know, a just someone coming in with a number, or sometimes they don't give you a name, they have robo-signers. But nevertheless, everything is traced back to someone generating that paperwork, plus the commissioner and any agents involved or any judges involved. We're going to put them all up there in the case under you know, the violation, and they either correct their errors and fix problems, or they will be indicted. That's what the paper is really saying. So next.
Okay. Does the government of the United States recognize the four elements of contract law? And if the government recognizes the four elements of contract law, where are the elements referenced?
Well, look, they're not concerned with that when it comes to the people, because as far as they're concerned, they're the master and you're the servant. That's how they really think. I mean, they think that they're sitting up there, that they're the master. All of these bureaucrats think that they're the master. You know, they really do. It's time to turn this thing around and get government to fear the people. And not to fear that we're going to do anything violent or anything, of course not, but to fear the people that they're going to have to pay the consequence in a court of justice, in a court of law. But anyway, can you read that question again?
Okay. Does the government of the United States recognize the four elements of contract law?
Okay. Yeah, contract. Yeah, they don't even... Look, they don't even honor their own rules. They don't honor even the statutes they're trying to apply upon you. And, you know, then there are statutes in there that protect you. They'll ignore those. And because you're in a jurisdiction unknown, they make it up as they go. That's what I see. They have a mindset. And no matter what you do, even if you move that court in a lawful matter, whether it be constitutional or even statutory, they will ignore that and continue their status quo to make sure that you are going to be guilty of this situation. And that's it. It is a sham. The whole thing is nothing but a RICO business. It's just really, really seriously defunct. And of course, that's why we're doing what we're doing. Okay.
Are we still moving forward with the non-judicial foreclosures? I don't see my name or my brother's name on the NLA.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, at the non-judicial foreclosures, when we're doing them, we do the joinder first, we do the amicus curiae, and nothing gets listed until we move it for cause. Once we move it for cause into the case, then that's when it'll be posted. And sometimes it may not be posted right away. You know, it takes time to catch up with paperwork sometimes. You know, we're really overloaded. We need a lot of help. Anybody that can volunteer in any way. There's so many committees we got going, so many things. People without experience in anything could learn things. People with experience, it'll help us, especially people with, you know, maybe paralegal background or something of that nature. But in any event, paperwork takes time. Look at We indicted the governor down there in Virginia a couple of weeks back. We still haven't filed the papers yet because we're backed up. We are writing and moving towards a lot of moving cases. We're hoping to get that going, finish off this week and catch up with that. And then those cases will be uploaded onto our page, as well as, of course, being filed with the court. So things take time. Courts take a lot of time to do things, and it really is aggravating sometimes. It may take 3 months to do something, and I presume it's because they're bogged down, and that's where we're at. Well, we're even more bogged down. You know, nobody gets really paid here, and everybody's volunteering, and it takes time. So anyway, next.
Okay, do they need to do anything else, or will that automatically just appear for their non-judicial foreclosure with a joinder?
Once the joinder's in and the paperwork is flowing, then Jim will work out whatever needs to be done. You know, the joinder comes first, okay, and then the paperwork follows behind it with an amicus curiae, which we have the people mail it in for us and for them. And then when the decision and order comes, then we move it to into the federal court for cause, and that's done also. We do all the paperwork, but the people mail that out. And then after that, when that time period is completed and they have their time to react and they don't and they default, we do an order and decision. And then after that, we move towards indictments. We can't have people's unalienable rights constantly violated and there's no consequences for these judges. It's time for them to be indicted. They need to pay the price. You know, they got to, they're just evil, you know, or dumb. We'll try to wake them up, but if they don't want to wake up, that's their problem. Next.
Okay, that's all the questions. My only announcement for tonight is that we still need 4 district directors for the committee men. District 1, Washington and Oregon. District 5, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. District 6, that'd be Kansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas, and Illinois. And District 7, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. So if you would like to volunteer or know someone you think might, please give them my email, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org, and have them send me a little note. We'll take it from there.
And those districts, there are 10 districts broken up there. And those districts, the leaders are going to be, you know, look at, you can't really separate the militia from the jury, from the committeemen. I mean, they're all one. They're the people. We're the people. So they're working all three, trying to work with the administrators, making sure we're getting 4 in each county, trying to work with the committeemen, making sure we get at least 5 in each county. And 5 is all we need in each county to be successful, because they can then anoint, so to speak, all of the people that are there. We can train them. We'll get rid of all the party bosses, and we can train them in the law. We can bring them up to get them educated on our website, and then we can show them how to become elected committeemen. And believe me, those people that are involved in that are really there. Most of them are there really to do something good. You know, they learned about this. They want to participate. They want to be the people to decide who gets under the ticket and all that stuff. But what happens after a while, you start to realize it's all BS, that it's just a show. It's a facade. You're not deciding anything. The bosses up top are deciding. And the people that are bosses within the county and within the state and on a federal level, there are bosses at all levels. They're all in the game for making money. They get all these political favors. You know, they're in business usually to maybe get the contract on the highway to pick up cars, you know, that are broke down. Maybe they'll get this contract or that. It's all a game. It's all about power and abuse of power, and doing favors for the people who are in the game to destroy our Constitution and our way of life. But anyway, most of the people are not in for that. And they get discouraged when they find out the truth. Sometimes it takes them years before they find out the truth. But after they find out the truth, a lot of them will just leave. So we have an opportunity to really, indoctrinate, so to speak, these people into common law. But this is the job of the people on this level that are taking up these 10 positions. And we want more than one in each district. You know, everybody should have a partner. Should be 2 people doing, because if you can't do something one time because you're going on vacation or you're sick or something, whatever it is, your partner can pick up the load and make sure things get done. Even three or four people is fine, too, in each district working together. There should always be a lead guy, but, you know, three or four people working together. So we need these 10 districts being filled by people who are willing to take a national leadership here with National Liberty Alliance and to work. I talked with Francine about this, and, you know, she's going to write up some, and we've got some things written up with duties and things, and she's going through some of those things now, and we're going to kind of rewrite some of them and make them a little more clearer, maybe some bullet pointing, and so people understand what their powers, you know, what their authority, what their powers, authorities, forget about that, what there was required of them in order to exercise their role as a district leader. And really, it's organizing the state, it's organizing the counties, it's organizing the militia within those counties, it's organizing the committeemen within those townships, and it's organizing the jury administrators in every county. And, you know, there are state leaderships, there's county leaderships and organizers. You know, everything going on in that particular one of 10 districts is really needs to be orchestrated by that leadership. So we do need leaders on the national level. We need leaders on the state level. We need organizers and leaders on the county level. We need leaders everywhere. We need the people, everybody, to step up and start doing work. Many hands make light work. I think that's how that's said. Next. Is that the last one?
Yes, that's the last one, John.
Okay, thank you. Gerard, back to you.
Okay, we have a number. I don't know where it's from. It starts with 760. I'm going to unmute you. You are unmuted.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Who is this?
My name is Christina.
Okay, that's good.
I actually called earlier today and I spoke with Jan. I have a question. I have a case, Superior Court case that's coming up in April. And it's a case management hearing. I am being sued for breach of contract. And I don't know what to do. I am new to the website. I just became a member and, you know, I'm...
Is this a breach of contract from a government position, a commercial?
No.
Who's against you? Who's coming up against you?
Brooksmore. There are a REIT company. I owned a store at a shopping center, and the business went down, was really, really slow, so I had to shut down the store a year and a half through the, you know, it was a three-year contract. And so I had to close the shop because there was just, it wasn't enough to cover the overhead. So they're suing me.
Well, I understand that. Did you do this in a corporate fashion? Did you create a corporation for this, or did you, or what, or
no.
did you do it a personal?
Oh. Yeah, it's a sole proprietorship.
So you did it as a DBA or a proprietor? How did you do it?
DBA is just sole proprietor, like my name and my social.
Okay. All right. That puts you into a personal thing. You know, anybody, look at, I take advantage of the corporations, even though I don't like them and I didn't want to do that. And I did DBAs and all that other stuff. But anytime I really did business, I did under the corporation. If the corporation folds and it's responsible for itself, generally speaking, they really can't go after, you know, the people behind the corporation in a sense, unless there's a crime, I presume anyway. That's what I understand. But the thing is the responsibility. You did sign a contract. You kind of stuck into it, but, you couldn't go forward. You didn't break the contract on purpose. You can try to make a case on that. You don't have the money to be able to pay whatever it is they want. Look, if you had the money to pay that, you would have stayed in business, you know. So they're chasing a dead thing, but, you know, there's nothing that we can really do for you here because we're dealing with people that are losing homes when the government's coming out,
well,
to assume people, IRS problems, people in jail.
It is.
Yeah?
Because I do own a home, and they're gonna come after my, I mean, because the...
Yeah, they are evil to do that. They're probably a big corporation or... a group of lawyers or something that, you know, they play that game. Let me think about this a minute. There is, what about the Homestead Act? And when you bought that home, are you under the Homestead Act?
Yes. No, I mean, I do know about the Homestead Act. It's, I mean,
is
I,
your
I
home can't. Under the Homestead Act?
No, no, it's
you
not.
Need to go back. You need to go down. I don't know if it's too late, but get it recorded to get under the Homestead Act. Because once you're under the Homestead Act, they can't take your home away. The only one that could do that, and they really can't do that, is the government. The government can't do that either, but they will do it because they think they're above the law.
But I thought even if you do have the homestead filed for homestead, they can still...
They cannot take your home away, no. If you're under the Homestead Act, they cannot take your home away. Unless something has changed that I'm not aware of. And, you know, but you do have to be careful because they could seize other properties. They could seize your accounts, and that's all a problem. Yeah, they're going to make life a mess for you. There's not much... Well, you know what? The only thing you could do is you can challenge the jurisdiction of the court, and you could take that to the federal level and make the point that this is not a common law court. It is not a court of record, and you might be able to – you'll definitely get some time to begin with because you should be able to put the case off to pursue that, number one, and you should win it, actually, number two, because they're operating outside of common law. Even though you have a contract with them, it still requires a untainted jury, and there should be, a properly run jury that's untainted, and that's rare.
Can I ask you another question? The contract that I signed, they sent me the only copy they gave me a copy, but there was no signature on it. But when they sued me, they came and they sent me the paperwork for me to get sued. There was a contract, but there was only one signature, my signature, and it was a copy, and then it was the president of the REIT company, Brixmore. They're based in New York. There was only one signature. So how would
now,
I...
What do you mean, only your signature?
There's my signature, and there's only... one other person's signature on there.
Okay, but what's the date? When was that dated? And was that dated? Did they have a date when that signature went on?
No, it was my... I signed it with...
Well, I see that happens a lot with... You'll get a contract, it's not signed yet, they're expecting you to make the signature, send it back to them, then they sign it, and then they send you a copy back. And... you know, look at there must be an original contract generated, and without original document, a copy doesn't hold. But I guess a copy could be verified, if they have a way to verify it. I know contracts that I've created and got involved with. I always usually do a in front of a notary public. We always
have. Yeah, it was just the guy who I hired.
Yeah, but it's still a contract. They're gonna hold your feet to the fire on that.
Right. Yeah.
You know, unless you could prove some fraud, but the only thing you could do is challenge the jurisdiction.
But John,
not being a court of record, and get some time. Yeah.
They have to produce that original contract, and they may not have.
Yes, that's true. Okay.
And that's what I won my case
maybe,
on.
Maybe
they could not produce an original contract, and the judge got tired.
Yeah, but that's true, okay, because they didn't have an original contract to begin with in your case. It just never existed, okay? With her case, okay, even though they went back and forth through the email or whatever they did or fax that do it, and they're copies and they're transmitted and copies and so on, that is true that those papers don't hold any weight in court, but they can be verified. Maybe Brent is still listening in, and maybe he can comment on this. But I believe they can be verified by someone that it's a true contract created in this fashion, and so on and so forth. Brent, if you're here, maybe you can comment on. Maybe you know more about this than I do. I don't have an answer to your problem per se. You're going to fight them. You're going to lose, unfortunately. You might be able to get away with challenging jurisdiction, and if they're not willing to move it into a court of record, you can win that way, at least keep them at bay. It is a problem, and it's a personal thing between you and another group of people. You know, it's not something that we deal with situations where the government is abusing their power and coming after people. Now, but again, you deserve a court of record. Brent, can you comment on verifying a document created and generated across maybe fax or email? Maybe Brent's not in no more. Maybe he's away. I don't see him. And I guess he's not here. You know, you can next Monday.
Here. I'm here.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I'm like Gerard. I have to find the button. Anyway, the thing is, this electronic signature situation, and that's kind of things you're talking about, verifying stuff, the courts are increasingly accepting such things. Now, when it comes to signatures and verification and certifications, traditionally, of course, it had to be an original. And I say traditionally, that hadn't been that many years ago. But the courts have always been prone to accept anything that they could justify as verified. If they could, they'd do it. And they'd bend over backwards, because all verification is, it's not a technical. People try to make it a technical thing. Oh, it's got the seal on it like they used to do. That means it's official. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's forged. Maybe the seal is not even. So when it comes to electronic stuff, the way you do it, the way I do it even now, because I never know what they'll accept and what they won't accept, I do everything I can to cover all the bases. And if I find out that the court will accept a certain thing that doesn't require that much effort, then that's what I'll do. But let me ask this question. Did you say, I'm sorry, I thought I heard the name Christine. Is that right?
Christina, yeah.
Oh, Christina. Christina. What state are you in, Christina?
San Diego, California.
Oh, okay. Well, is there any chance in this situation that you could hire a lawyer?
Well, I could, but I'm going to lose anyway, so I'm just trying to figure out if I...
Well, my question is, if you go to a lawyer that's in California, that's in San Diego, that knows the game in California and locally in San Diego, he might tell you, no, I think you can win. You don't know what he might say.
I had three consultations. I did meet with three different attorneys. Oh. They said, oh, we should negotiate for you.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I could negotiate myself. Why should I hire?
Well, that is probably your best option, is try to negotiate agreement with them and be square. Look, I'm just a person struggling to be in business. Hold on a minute. Listen, you make your point. I'm just a person struggling to be in business. Things didn't turn out the way I had hoped. I don't have the money to go forward. You try and sue me for money that's not there. But, you know, maybe we can work something out and I can pay over time a certain amount of money. But, you know, look, at I can't. You're not going to get the water out of a dry well, you know?
Yeah. Well, he did. They sent me an email. This was in December before Christmas, asking me to do a settlement of $45,300. And I said, I decline. I don't have that money. All I can pay is $10,000, that's all I can pay on a monthly plan. But I have not heard back from the attorney. And
right.
I replied back again. I said,
Well, that's the way to go. That's the way to go. You try and negotiate, you know. Look, I was stuck in the same kind of a situation years ago, and business didn't go well. And they, you know, but they never went forward to try to collect off me, so it never went anywhere. I mean, I probably would have lost if they did. In that business, I'm trying to think. I'm pretty sure I usually incorporate for everything. I'm pretty sure for that one I did. I did a partnership with someone else to do something. So, but again, you know, it sounds like you're liable. It sounds like they're going to get you. And it sounds like the best thing to do is make a deal that is reasonable. And, you know, if you make a really good, reasonable deal with them, And they did pull you into court, and you tell the judge, look, judge, I tried to work out a deal with these people. You know, you can't get water out of a dry well, and I'm willing to do something. And this is what I offered them, and they turned it down. And this is the only thing possible. Look at what I have. This is the only thing possible I could do. You know, there may be, you know, a situation in that case. You'll have a judge sort of on your side. Now, again, they're going to try to make this decision with a judge and without a jury, and you got to decide whether you want that or not. But remember, you know, you're going to need a lawyer if you're going for a jury, and you're going to get a jury that may be tainted. You got to be careful. You got to see if there's something going on in the courts. I've been involved in a case which was personal and business, but the guy that I was going up against was connected with the judge. He was his accountant. So, and I should have won this case. Yeah, I should have won this case.
My question is, we have this case management hearing, the CMC hearing. What goes on in those hearings? Is it just, are they going to ask me? What kind of questions are they going to be asking me?
Well, they're going to want to know everything that you own. They're going to know bank accounts. They want to know everything, and you got to be careful because you can't lie in there. You know, I can't give you too much advice on that. Maybe Brent might want to comment a little on that kind of a thing, but they're going to ask questions. You got to be careful.
Well, the best position you can be in is not own anything. Then you don't have to lie.
Right.
That's always a good position.
It's how I live my life.
Yeah. I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me is not a bad deal if you're in a situation like that, but he makes a good point. Whatever you do, don't lie under oath. The judge won't like it. But I want to make one other comment about lawyers. Lawyers like spare tires are in the way till you really need one. If you really had one, it does put a threat in what you're doing. Sometimes, not always, but it's like pulling a gun. It'll make the other side say, well, her intentions are serious. But if not, I agree. You can negotiate. It depends upon what you can do. But in this situation, pardon?
They haven't responded back to me.
I'm sorry, say that again.
They have not responded back to me. I responded back in December, and they haven't replied back to me. And I followed up with the lawyer, but no response back from him.
I see. Well, that'd be all the advice I'd have, not knowing any advice. I don't want to call it advice. That wouldn't be right.
You're not my client.
But that's the only thing that I could notice or say, not knowing any more about it than I do and not knowing you. But I do know that there are some fundamental things that you can do. And one of them is don't own anything and don't lie.
And why don't you make a phone call to them and find out what's going on? Say, hey, look, I sent you some communications. It's been over 30 days. You guys haven't gotten back to me, and I'm really trying to settle this problem. See what they do and say. You know, when you get a communications on the phone and it's a person to person, it's a voice to voice, you know, generally speaking, you know, if you can get a lawyer on the other end that isn't just a hard ass, you know, all of a sudden a human factor could come into it.
Yeah, I know. That's the other thing.
And I wouldn't, if there's individuals that you can talk directly and they're talking through an attorney, if they're willing to talk with you, not being an attorney, I'd talk with them and try to work a deal out with them, even cut out the lawyer. Say, hey, why are you bothering to hire a lawyer? I can't afford to pay enough money that's going to pay for your lawyers to begin with, plus what I owe you. That's not going to happen, so that's just a dream, a pipe dream. But look, let's try to work something out. You know, I only have so much. Try to work the deal out. But, you know, a lawyer can't go around another lawyer's back to do that. But you're not a lawyer. I don't see why you couldn't. Do you see a problem with that, Brent?
No. That's right. There are certain things that lawyers can't do. They'll get disbarred or disciplined. But you're not a lawyer. You're not under that code.
Try to go directly to the people and work it out and make it clear to them, you know, that look, at if you want to go to court, okay, you're going to spend a lot of money on attorneys. You're looking to get a certain amount of money from me. I don't have it. You're not going to get it.
They're a REIT company. They're a big company. I mean, it's not like
what do they have, like a board? They have a board of directors to it, a president and a CEO and all that stuff? Go look for the CEO or the president. Find someone who you can negotiate with other than the legal department. I mean, but again, those big companies, you're right, they'll probably push it down to the legal department because they got a contract, they got, you know, they got lawyers that are just
I was late a couple of times, and their attorney contacted me. It wasn't even them. So it was like everything was through their attorney.
Yeah. All right, well, look, that's all the advice we can give you. I wish we could help you. If this was the government coming down on you, we're in it. We're in the game for that.
Yeah. All right.
But it's difficult on the personal end of things, you know?
I know. All right. It's okay. Thank you so much. Thank you
for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, we have, looks like Suzanne from North Carolina is next. Go ahead, Suzanne. Hello? Suzanne. Going once, are you there? 970 area code.
Yes, I'm here.
There she is. Go ahead, what's your question?
I was asking a question regarding, on the earlier tax call, regarding the, basically, in 2010, the IRS filed automatic returns, and then just this spring, my spouse, so they claimed that he owed like $120,000 in back taxes from made-up returns. Anyway, the Department of State of the federal government, who you send your passport to, sent a letter back to him saying he couldn't, they would not issue the passport because he owed more than $50,000 to the IRS. So I'm wondering if there would be,
Sounds like extortion to me. They do that with driver's licenses also. That's all illegal. It's extortion. It's nothing less than that. That you haven't been found guilty of nothing that the government can go out and do. Where is the code? Where is their statute that provides for that, number one? And if there is one, I'll show you how that's unconstitutional.
Right. So the question is, would we write a letter and basically to the Department of State, like, hey...
Absolutely. Look, I would find all parties involved, okay, and I address it to all of them, and I do a notice and demand to them. And I'd ask where the fiduciary authorities are, okay? Because someone has to have fiduciary authority over you in order to do something like take money from your bank account or garnish your income or your Social Security or do something to remove a license or something that has nothing to do with this, and it's a different agency and everything else. Where's the fiduciary authority? Where is that? That's a federal requirement now to file it with the federal court, which I think it's a Form 56, or could be the 4490. I forget the two mixed up. One's fiduciary authority, the other one is a proof of claim. So where is that? Who did that? You see, you do your notice and demand, do your homework, and do your notice and demand. You can learn how to do a notice and demand on our website under education. And you can find out, there are 8 points you have to hit, okay? At the end, you have to have, this is what you're going to do. If they don't respond, that they're going to default, and this is what you're going to do, and this is what you're going to expect. You're going to take control over them. And if they don't respond, then you have the authority to take control over them. Make sure it's served properly, just like you were going to a court. Get certified with a return slip. And also, at the same time, if you can have it personally serve it personally, have someone else do that. Have that other someone else also deposit it into the mail with certified return slip. I mean, all that stuff. And in 30 days, then you do a default on them. Then if things don't work out too well at that point and they're still ignoring, you're not going anywhere, then you go into the local court and you open up a case to show cause why a judgment shouldn't be taken against them. You've already done the court case. It's over. They defaulted. Bring in your notice and demand. Bring it through the process. And you could win that way.
Well, I guess the thing is, it's never been to any kind of court. I would just sending, like, would I...
You're opening your own court when you do a notice and demand.
Okay.
You're opening up your own... Look, when I go to file a case against someone on the state level, here in New York, you have to get, first of all, you got to get a... you got to file for an index number, okay? And that, I'm trying to think, I think that's $100, okay, or 90, no, it's $95, okay. Then you have to file for an RJI, which is a request for judicial request for judicial into, what's the word I'm looking for here, Gerard? RJI, request for judicial, well, I forget the word, but it's for them to interfere, I guess. But the thing is I don't know, what state are you in?
Well, I'm right now in North Carolina.
Okay.
Driver's license is Colorado.
Well, let me make the point. Let me make the point, and it doesn't matter what state you're in. I do it this way, so first of all, I don't want to put the $210 in, because it requires $210 to get the RJI, which they shouldn't be charging anything for, and it's $95 for the index number. Again, it shouldn't be charged for. But when you file that index number, you're now in the battle for the court case, okay? They got 30 days to respond, and you got 30 days to respond, and you're going back and forth, and the argument is made, and you don't go move into the court until you're done with that. Now, lawyers like to do it all in one shot and bring it into the court right away. I've filed cases, only paid the $95, and I never file for the RJI, but I always find that the other side will push it through, and they'll put the $210 down. See, for me, it's a saving of money on the one hand. But on the other hand, it just gets me into the place where we can start arguing, and they got to answer. But first start with your default that works out through a notice and demand. You're giving them 30 days to respond. Then you give them the default and what your expectations are and your collections are in that. Then they're going to ignore that. Then you move it into the court. Just file. If they separate it like they do here in New York, just do the RJ, just do the index number. File for that. File it into the case. And let the other side move it into the court, because they will eventually. Let them pay the $210. Or you may have to pay the whole thing. I think it's, $305 altogether. At least here in New York it was last time I filed the case. And but you should be able to win the case, because the case is really over by the time you get it into the court. The battle has been done, and you'll accept a decision by a judge. But if they're not going to be on your side, then you're expecting a court of record with a jury.
Okay, but the letters would initially go to the Department of State that denied the passport.
Well, you're going to go after them too, absolutely, because you see the pressure is going to be on them to show by what authority. What authority did you have to do that? Where is the due process that you think you could do that? I have a right to be able to travel. I have an unalienable right to be able, you know, it is a requirement to get something to identify yourself as you move into from one country to another, and you have a passport. They can't take that away from you. And maybe that's preventing you from making money. Maybe that has something to do with your business. You need to be able to travel. I mean, they're only really just destroying you as much as they can. More, they're not interested in really solving the case. They're interested in destroying people and pushing them into submission and making you an example. At least that's all I can figure out of all this stuff. So, anyway, learn.
Statute of limitation too, like, is this?
There is no statute of limitation for you. You're one of the people.
Not for me, for them. Like,
oh, if there's a statute of limitation for them, absolutely, I'd hold that up.
Like, they filed the lien in 2013, after making up the tax returns in 2010.
Well, that was a fraud. When they made up your tax returns, you see, you have to go after them in the same. You have to sit and think this out, and it does take some thought. And then after you finish your paperwork, you step back and you look at it, and you have to think again. You have to look and see, you know, how things work. You have to understand, for instance, how a notice and demand works and what the criteria of that is. Again, there's 8 points that need to be made in that. But look at, they had no fiduciary authority over you unless there was a court order, and they never have that. They had no authority. People just, look at, I can't believe that lawyers are so brain dead that they don't even see it so clearly there. Even when you go into this thing, when the IRS is trying to take fiduciary authority over you, and they tell you by what authority they act, even when you go down that rabbit hole to figure out what's going on, it has to do with people that are involved in businesses with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, and also gasoline, fuels, jet fuels, all that kind of thing,
right.
That type of business. That's the only people. But even with that, inside, as you go down the rabbit hole, you discover that they still require a court order. You see, the whole thing is a fraud. They're operating without a court order. They're operating without any authority over you. Nobody's got fiduciary authority. Who signed the papers? That person belongs in jail. That's my how I would go about this. Okay, I'd be
okay.
A little careful how I say that. But, you know, I would say that person committed a crime. I wouldn't say they belong in jail. That person committed a crime. Are they above the law? By what authority? By what powers? How do you act? You see, they're not going to be able to answer it if you take your time and you work through this process slowly. And what you're doing is you're trying to create a paper that they cannot answer. They can't respond to, so they'll default. And if they had to go to court, if you pull them into court, okay, now they got to answer in court or they can't answer. They're going to have to make a deal.
Right. Well, this whole thing is funny, I think, is the automatic business, I forget what they called it, automatic, how they make up a return. They determined like 2 years ago that that was not enforceable, and they got rid of the department, is my understanding.
Oh, well, bring that issue up. You know, right. You're using their stuff against them also. And I still would want to know about the fraud, these people committing fraud back then. You know, even though they thought they had that ability, they still have to have fiduciary authority. Who gave them fiduciary authority over my life? I'm not an invalid. I never gave that away to no one. No judge has committed me as being unable to make decisions for myself and gave fiduciary authority over me to someone. That's never happened. Who gave that to you? I want to know. Oh, well, that happened 2 years when I hold. I don't care who did that. Who that's a crime. You see, you got to push that issue.
Right. Well, the other thing is that in 2011, we filed a rescission of our signatures on, like, I realized that this was all just a big voluntary compliance and there's a whole lot of non-disclosure going on. So I wrote this whole paper and sent it in to the IRS.
Just so you know, that makes you a target, but I understand that.
Well, whatever. I did that in 2011 and rescinded our signatures back to the beginning.
Oh, well, that's a long time ago. They probably, well, you know, things will boil up, but that is a long time ago, but that's good. So, you know, look, at the bottom line is since then you haven't had a signature on a piece of paper. Let me tell people, the day you sign, when they start badgering you, if you have not been signing their papers and sending in things on a yearly basis, they don't have your signature. They have no agreement. And when they start badgering you, they want you to get to agree to something. We want $50,000. You know, this is what you're, oh, well, come on in. We'll talk about it. And they can get you down to maybe a little bit less. You know, maybe they get you down to $5,000 or $2,000. And then you sign. Well, we're now working on last year, which we didn't get to. And by the way, you owe us $80,000. You're in the game. You're stuck. You see what I'm talking about? Or they come after you for failure to file because you acquiesced by putting your signature down. Okay?
Well,
so you're in trouble.
I filed a return since like 2005 or something.
Right. That's old. I wouldn't worry about it no more. Okay? But now,
well,
you know, once you look it, you don't want to ever ignore them. You must answer them. Again, I answer affidavit. My letters are affidavits. SS-1 statement up top, the county, and then on the bottom, I put the stuff for the notary. I write my letter. I sign it in front of a notary. I get two copies, two originals. One I keep in my record. The other one I send to the principal individuals I'm chasing down, and so on. So, but the bottom line is that you want to. I don't refute anything they say. I just say, I don't understand where you got this. Can you please send me the proof of claim? And I give them a copy of the fiduciary of the proof of claim paper, which is I think that's the 4490. And by the way, you know this. You broke into my bank account and you got information. I sent you a letter. I told you not to do that. You did it anyway. Could you please send me a copy of fiduciary authority that gave you to do that? And also maybe the court order that also gave you the authority to break an entry. Can you please send that to me too? And I really want to obey the law, and I don't understand how I owe taxes on this kind of money. So it needs to be explained to me before I can, you know, give you anything. And I'm certainly not going to sign any papers that I don't understand. How can I do that? You're asking me to sign something and defraud the whole thing because I don't even know what's going on. You see, that's how you want to word these things. You know, you want to participate. You want to help them. You want to do what's lawful. But I don't know. You're telling me things that I have no knowledge of. Enlighten me so I can deal with it.
My other, I guess the IRS has not ever taken directly any money from us on those liens. They just filed the notice of lien, and I know it's just a notice. But Wells Fargo Bank has on a number of times garnished wages for property taxes.
And again, so again, where's the fiduciary authority? Who gave them that fiduciary?
Right.
You see, here's again, here's, hold it. This is extremely important. Stop, listen.
Okay.
This happens to people, everyone needs to know this and understand this, okay? And this happens to a lot of people. When they're going to garnish you or anything, when anything's going to happen, they have to, and they do live up to this rule. You know, it's part of their requirements, it's policies and procedures, it's code, whatever you want to call it, okay? If they're going to, for instance, seize your money, okay, or they're going to, usually it starts with the file of lien. They give you notice. They give you a 7-day notice. Or they give you a 7-day notice. They may not tell you how many days, but they give you a notice of their intent, okay, to summons the bank. So what they'll do is they may send the summons to you and to the bank all at the same time, and then they have to wait X amount of days before they execute it. Well, why are they waiting X amount of days to execute it? Because the requirement is you can deny that execution and say, give me my due process. Now, even if you do that, they're going to do it anyway, but I'll talk about a way to deal with that. But the thing is now they're just breaking another law, okay? They cannot seize your money without requesting. It falls under the Safe Harbor Act, okay? And so you have rights, and you have protections, privacy rights. So they can't do this without having fiduciary authority and or a court order. Well, both, either one will give them the fiduciary authority, court order. Now, the other thing, and here's the main thing, and this is how what I had did once before, is the moment they serve notice of a lien on property and they're going to file it with the county clerk, I immediately sued the county clerk, I sued the sheriff, I sued the banks, I sued everybody. And I sued the IRS, I sued the commissioner, I sued the agents, and we went to court. And nobody could do anything because they were all frozen up in court. The county couldn't receive a lien against any kind of an illegal or, you know, unverified. Can't receive a lien from the IRS at all, okay? The sheriff couldn't execute it, and it froze everybody up. And then I won the case. So the thing is, you have to always respond to every letter, and don't put it aside for, I'll deal with it later in the month, I don't want to think about it. No, open it up right away, get it over with. Jump into the water. It may be cold, it'll get a little warmer. Just jump in the water, go do it. Open that paper and respond right away. Don't let them have anything where they can get you past the 30 days or even 7 days or 10 days if they're going to seize.
Right, that's what was so tricky about the whole thing. Past, can't receive any letters for like since 2015. Like we moved from the house to, and had put a board of address in, but anyway, they claimed when I was looking at the history that they mailed it to our address that we moved the end of 2015. And then, you know, we applied for the passport in 2019. So it's like we hadn't gotten any letters.
Right. Well, look, the only way you're going to deal with that is, like I told you, you can have it reversed, okay? You know, again, you know, I had a situation where, you know, they did that and they did it anyway, and then you go back with the paper. Hey, you know, we already told you that you want to take that money. You need to go in and either get a court order, but I'm certainly not giving you any authority. There's nobody else that has fiduciary authority over me, so go see a judge if you think you can get it off of him. But I want my money back, and I want you to stop taking that money out. And you got X amount of days to fulfill that. And if you don't, this is what's going to happen to you. There are 8 points, like I told you, in a notice and demand. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do this, and I have all the authority and decision-making to rule for you. Okay? You know, I forget the wording, but you'll read it in it. There's an example laid out, and you pretty much use the example and put your own details in it. But you'll find it up on our website. Go get educated, and then we can talk some more.
Okay, sounds great. Thank
yeah,
you
you'll
so
find
much.
It under education, court forms, process, and instructions. I'm pretty sure you'll find it there. You'll find a Goodness, what is notice and demand? We have it in PDF and in Word. We have a lot of stuff on that page, by the way. Okay, so it does require that page. There's very little. Again, we used to give everything away for free. There wasn't a thing we didn't do that we gave away for free. Every course, everything we'd done. But we asked for, you know, donations, and we never were getting enough to survive. So there are two things we did. This information like this, to get access to this page, you have to be a premium member, or to get access to our, government by consent course, you have to be a premium member. And a premium member is someone who gives $5 a month or more, so that's, what, $60 a year, you know? Everybody can afford that. But in any event, you know, that keeps us alive, keeps us going, and also gives people a lot of different things. I mean, you can download here. We have, if you don't have a copy of Black's Law, we have a copy of Black's Law up here. We have a lot of stuff on this page. So, helpful stuff that'll teach you how the court works, teach you how a lot of things, you know, how to write a notice and demand. But with that, we need to move on. But get a little educated in those areas, start working it out, and you can quiz us some more as you get a little more and closer and wording, and we'll give you some thoughts. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we got Ted, looks like, from Georgia next. Go ahead, Ted. You've been unmuted. Hello? Ted from Georgia, going once, and twice.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was muted after all.
There you go.
Oh, hi.
Hey, what's going on?
Appreciate all the information. I've gotten a letter from the IRS. They want me to appear, et cetera. So I really wanted to know what the name of the person was that was giving all the great tax advice.
We don't
or
give
the
tax
IRS advice. No. I mean the IRS dissertation.
Right. Yeah. We don't give advice. We give thoughts and ideas. But
yes, I understand. I misspoke.
From the perspective of the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, we are coming from that perspective when we do what we're doing here. And we're going into the court, to the United States Supreme Court, and we're chasing after them for the responsibility of this whole thing. They have permitted an unlawful court to operate within all federal districts, and this is a conspiracy, this is RICO, and this is really destruction of our Constitution, a slave tax. And then so we're going after the United States Supreme Court for that and the federal district courts, and we're going to name, of course, the quote-unquote agency that is not an agency, which is called the IRS, and its law enforcement arm, which is the ATF, okay? But in any event, we're filing a paper against them. And anybody who wants to join with us on that, you give us an affidavit. Did you come to earlier the meeting today?
I actually got on a little late because I was running behind, so I missed.
Okay,
we had
a special meeting. We're going to have another. We're going to have a special meeting every Monday until we get to this point. At 8:30, we'll be coming on. Yeah, I guess 8:30. We'll do it 8:30. 8:30, we'll be here half hour early for the sole purpose of discussing IRS affidavits and questions and things. But it's really very simple, okay? What you want to do is this. Go out to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. I do have one open. Highlight grand jury and come down to indictment consideration for February 6th, 2020, which is this Thursday. Okay, highlight that. Come down and you'll read the paper on this. IRS writ quorwanto draft. And that's
right,
going to give you
that's
the paper. That's the paper we're going to be filing. So it should be pretty empowering and a little confidence in it with what we've got written there and how we're going to go about doing this. And anybody who wants to attach an affidavit to this, we will take that affidavit and attach it. Just go through... We then have a place where you can go create your affidavit. If you come under abuse of courts, click on abuse of courts, come down, read that page very carefully, come down towards the bottom, it says click here to fill out the form, go there, and then when you get to that page, you'll see IRS cases only, do not fill out the form below, click the IRS affidavit and follow the instructions. So go to the IRS affidavit, it's in PDF and Word form, read through it very carefully, follow the instructions, start working on your affidavit. Come to us next Monday at 8:30, between 8:30 and 9, to ask any questions, any concerns. You can also ask some questions to intake at National Liberty Alliances, which where you'll send a copy of your, draft copy of your affidavit before you actually complete it, and they'll give you advice there. And make sure you mention the names of the people that are harassing you, and they will get a copy of our case. And their names will be listed as defendants, so we're drawing them into this. And under threat of indictment, which we're going to decide on this Thursday. Brent, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I got a question for you, because I don't know if you were around when we were talking about this.
Well, before you ask your question, I want to tell this fellow, if he would, get on the website commonlawyer.com and email me. I want to talk to him. Give me his phone number.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the web address.
Go to commonlawyer.com. That's the website. And then you can email me from there. If you email from the contact page and give me your phone number, I want to talk to you.
Okay, perfect.
Commonlawyer.com. Okay, thanks. John, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, for this person and others also, there was a little bit of a talk about conflict of interest. Now, I'm going to try to trap you, so be careful and listen very carefully.
All right.
Because I'm going to trap myself, too.
Mm-hmm.
At least I think I already have. I'm bound up at the moment. Uh-huh. Okay, here's the situation. We the people going after the government for our rights of due process, our rights of Second Amendment rights. Let's just take the Second Amendment rights. Well, we all have skin in the game, okay? That doesn't prevent us from sitting on the grand jury because, after all, we are the people, number one. We are being violated, number two. And it's not a conflict of interest because we all want that right, whatever our unalienable rights are, and one among them is the right to bear arms. Well, that being the case, in the IRS situation where it's a slave tax and we have the right not to be slaves, is it a conflict of interest for those people who are being abused by the IRS to sit in on a decision by the grand jury to cast their vote yea or nay for an indictment? What do you think about that?
So I don't understand who you're saying is on the grand jury. Are you saying the IRS sits on the grand jury?
No. We, our grand jury, we the people.
Oh, your grand jury, yeah.
Right. Now, we have people who are being abused by the IRS, and we're going to do indictments against those people or threats of indictments with papers, and they're going to attach their papers with us. Those people who attach their papers to our case, and because it's an unalienable right, I think that separates them from conflict of interest.
No,
and allows
I
them to sit on the jury.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. If government employees, federal and state, can sit on juries, grand or petit, then a situation like you're describing, they certainly can sit on juries. But it's worse that government employees sit on juries in tax cases. That's a serious conflict of interest.
Absolutely. So I don't see a conflict for interest with us because they're trying to enslave us, abuse us, threaten us, cause RICO, to go crazy here and make all the money off of us. And and we the people have a right to step up and say, nope, can't do that. After all, we did that with the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, and the rules of evidence, on top of what you said, the rules of evidence don't apply in grand juries any more than they apply in impeachments of presidents of the United States. People talk about the evidence and due process. That stuff is not required. The Senate of the United States can do as it pleases, and it does. That's why you see all this. But it's the same thing with a grand jury. And the House of Representatives, the common law rules of evidence don't necessarily apply if they don't want them to, and they don't. But in the grand jury, the evidence rules don't apply either. They can listen to anything they want. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you on that, and I've thought, watching what's going on here on the federal level here, you know, I've come to realize, and I'm seeing other people are thinking the same way too, is that a you know, the Congress acts as a grand jury. They gather the information, they consider it, and they indict. You know, usually a prosecutor brings it to them. They look at all this, and they indict. So all that process works there. Then they press it over to go into the court. And to go into the court, all the paperwork's got to be done. All of the people involved, everything and all that stuff has got to be ready. The witnesses, it's all done back there. It's not done in court. Now, sometimes you can find a witness and you can get maybe potentially, at least a judge may think he could do this, and maybe he has the authority to do this. But to decide, well, okay, even though this person was a witness, you know, it's someone just discovered or something, I'm going to allow it. I don't know. But let's lay that aside. Mm-hmm. But the way that our founding fathers set this up, I found it very interesting. And when I first saw it and looked at this, I thought in a certain term. But watching what, in a certain way, but watching what's going on, I'm beginning, well, they're seeing it a whole different way. When they decided that the Chief Justice was going to sit and preside over that hearing, then he was going to operate as a magistrate on the one end. But because he's a judge, he also has judicial powers and can do certain things, okay, if it's warranted. When a right is violated, it's the duty of a judge to fix that right. And so in certain situations, I think, although you're not going to see it happen because, you know, what's his name, the Chief Justice Roberts, you know, he's already denied participation in a 50-50 break vote on the one hand, but it also sounded like he wanted to keep hands off on the other hand, okay? When there is no charges, okay, and there is no charges, there is no codes violation, which is required under government, you know, activities. They have to violate a code. And since there is no code that they violated, there is no case, and it's the duty, in my opinion, of that judge to make that ruling, even though he's not the Senate. That's why our founding fathers put a Chief Judge Justice to preside over it. At least that's my logical thinking. So what do you think about it? I'm not too familiar with the arguments that may have taken place in the Federalist concerning that, and I got to go look that to see what they had to say, if anything. But what do you think?
About the Chief Justice throwing it out, you mean?
Well, the Chief Justice having the power to throw it out.
Oh,
maybe,
certainly. No. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe the other side, you know, maybe the Senate has to, you know, the well, not the Senate, but the defense attorneys, maybe they have to bring it before the judge. We want this thrown out because of this. I don't think they need a Senate vote for that. I think the judge has to rule on the law because it's the law now. There's nothing, you can't overrule the law.
Well, it says right here, let me just read it. This is the Constitution. This is Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. That's the first sentence. When setting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. Okay. Number three, when the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present. That's all it says, and as I like to say about all the Constitution of the United States, it doesn't explain anything. It just throws out the principle. So what do we depend upon here? Well, we should depend upon our common law, as always. Well, what does the common law say? Well, the common law says that the branches of government are separate and co-equal, and they're absolutely independent. They're sovereign, not sovereign, that's not the best word. They are in control themselves. No other branch of government tells them what to do or is allowed to interfere in any way. And so that means they can do what they want, whatever they can get away with, or whatever they want to do that's right. That's what's going to happen in the Senate of the United States. Now, they've got to come up against maybe what the Chief Justice wants. For example, he told Senator Paul from Kentucky that he wasn't even going to entertain his question. He wasn't going to listen to it. He was going to dismiss it and throw it out. Well, he can do that. Well, if the Senate wants to stop the whole caboodle and say, we're not going to put up with this anymore, you could have a serious fight on your hands, and it would be tug of war. But who, pray tell, is going to enforce anything the Chief Judge does there? Who's going to enforce anything that the Senate does? See, this is all political. they're going to be able to get away with that. This is the way it's supposed to be. This is the political element of our common law government. They're going to get away with whatever they think they can get away with. And this is a grandstand show that the founders never considered, never knowing that there was going to be such a thing as television and radio and internet. But now it's changed things a little bit because we know about it. But the political element is bigger than it ever could have been when the Constitution was written, because of the involvement of all of us. Just the feel, the swell of the emotion of 3 million people, or however many people are here. I mean, even me, I pay no attention to this stuff, but I can't help but know what's going on, and I have a feeling about it. And that feeling combines with others, and they all up there, they feel all that. And so that's the power of all of our psyche, our conscience is working together. There's something to all that. But I'm just going to come back to the point you were making and the question you were raising. This is a political free-for-all with an independent branch of government, and they will do whatever they can get away with doing, whether it's right or wrong. That's my observations from history and from my own lifetime watching.
Yeah, but, you know, I agree with what you're saying, and particularly this is what they're doing, and making it right or wrong is really what we're discussing, but they're looking into the political side of things. But, look, we are a common law nation. We're under common law. We've given authority under common law. We received our authority from God through the Declaration of Independence when we covenanted with him to live under his law and his blessings and his liberty and all of that together. Now, when we get into the courts and they make their rules, for instance, and I'm going to eventually get back to this point, but anyway, you get into the courts and they make their rules of the court, you know, maybe they can make certain procedural rules, but they can't make rules beyond the procedures. But they have, of course. They don't have the powers. They're under the rules of the common law, even though they are in a, in a court of equity. When they're acting under codes, okay? So they're in a court of equity, but it must operate under the rules of common law because we're a common law nation and it's a common law process. The only equity court that has true authority over man is one that has received its power from its proper source. And it's that equity, has they have received the power to legislate in a certain, you know, area, which we defined in Article 1, Section 8, okay, so they have their powers and their authority to make the necessary laws, as long as they're not repugnant to the rest of the Constitution, particularly our rights, the capstone. But nevertheless, okay, even though this is equity law, but it is given by we the people, who have been given the authority by God, which goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, you know, where we're told ultimately to, how did God put it, I forget the word he used, but that victory over the, oh goodness.
Didn't he say something about being good stewards?
Yeah, but he told us to have control,
dominion.
To have what?
Dominion.
Well, dominion, but there's something else. You know, it was as if there was a battle going on and we had to succeed over it. I'll see if I can look it up real quick when I take a break from speaking, and I'll pop it in. I'll just go to, I should be able to find it pretty quickly in the book of Genesis. But in any event, okay, God gave us his authority because we have a desire to live under his rule and law. So we became a common law nation. So our equity courts is lawful, providing they still preside underneath common law. So with that said, even the arguments made in Congress or in the Senate, shall I say, a lot of the comments were made is the right of due process, and that they failed the president in giving him the right of due process. They cut him off. They didn't allow him to have representation, to question the witnesses, to dig deeper, to pull in his own witnesses, all in preparation to bring the case in. They denied him all that. And they're making that case, which they're looking to win in the court, because they're bringing common law in, a right of due process. And if the right of due process is in, all of the rules of common law is in there. Now, whether they acknowledge it or whether they do it, that's one thing, but it's what they should be doing, okay? And this judge should have the ability to throw this out because there's nothing there. It's a nothing burger, okay? And the Senate shouldn't be able to do a darn thing about it, even if he takes it. Well, maybe the judge has to be, even though he's acting as a magistrate, not a judge in this case, there are certain, when a right is being violated, he now has to put on his cap as a judge. Or if he's a magistrate, he needs to look up to his boss, the judge, somewhere mm-hmm. above his line to say, hey, there's a problem going on. Can you give us a writ mandamus on this? Because I can't speak in this court. Rights are being violated. People are being suppressed and hurt and damaged. You know, do something. See, someone with that authority has got to come in and step in. And that's why we put the Chief Justice there, okay, to apply the rule of law. And the rule of law requires that if there is no charges, there is no case. If there is no affidavit, there is no case. There's nothing. It's a nothing burger. And that's a duty. Now, I know they're not going to do that, okay? And they're going to go to the vote of the Senate, because I think at this point you don't need the vote of the Senate, but they're not going to get a three-quarters vote as a guilty anyway, no matter what they do at the total end of things. It's just a matter of keeping the narrative in the
They've got another problem, too, because this justice is tied up with Epstein, so he's tainted. It's
just, oh, yeah. Subdue, by the way, is the word I'm looking
for.
Doesn't
matter what he does. He's got a problem, this guy. So that's, I mean, that's, this whole thing has got so many convoluted things like that, you know?
Right. Well, the word I was looking for was subdue, okay? That's the order that God gives us to subdue it. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Why did he say to subdue it? What's going on? It's to bring it into subjection. Okay? That's what subdue means. And have dominion over the fish in the sea and over the fowls of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So what are we to subdue? Okay? Well, look at we're to maintain the authority of God and we have common law. It starts out the law of God. You know, God speaks.
And the critters of Congress.
Huh?
Including the critters of Congress.
Yes, yeah, they're those critters, yeah. Anyway, that's my thinking. You want to have a final thought on that, Brent?
Well, sure. I have a friend. I have a friend that says we're supposed to subdue the land, and he says, well, what are we made of? We're made of dirt, so we should start with subduing ourselves if we're commanded to subdue the land.
Oh, that's true.
So
yeah,
I think he makes a good point. Yeah, makes a good point. but
remember, at that point, they didn't sin yet. Okay. So there was nothing to subdue. They didn't sin yet, though. That's before the fall.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. Well,
The devil was there. The devil was there. The temptation was there. Subdue.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
That's fundamental.
Yes.
And that, by the way, that's the reason why, fundamentally, that we have habeas corpus. Because you can't, and this is true, I'm not just rattling off words. This has been our common law since the beginning. You can't scatter and subdue the land and scatter out over it if you're falsely imprisoned. That's why it's so important in our common law tradition. It's not a part of any of the rest of the world.
Well, amen to that. All right. I don't know if you want to take one more question or not, Gerard, but it's at the end of the evening.
I don't have a carriage anymore. I don't have a pumpkin because it's after midnight, but I'll unmute Jay because I see he's in there. Jay, go ahead. We're working on negative time now. Go ahead.
Okay, well, it's pretty easy. So I was looking over the case, and then after the case, you know, it's got the sections of the code that they're violating, right? Under the IRS case, you know, a lot of those codes say any representative, servant or employee of the U.S. government, you know, cannot violate this code, whatever. Is the IRS exempt from that because they're not employees of the government?
Heck, they're not even chartered. I don't know what, you know, they're like in gray land over there. I don't think
they
have
any.
Well,
a lot of the sections of the code that you have under there for the case, I'm thinking, don't apply to them because they're not employees.
Well, they're all it's all fantasy, okay? Number one. Okay, and first of all, but second of all, the only people required to put a report in on themselves, ultimately who are putting a report in on commercial activities, if they're dealing with alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and gasoline fuels, jet engine fuels, storage, transportation over roadways, or farming, purchases of fuel for farming. You see, it's very, very detailed on what their authority is over. And if you're not dealing in those businesses, then they have no power or authority over you. Even the government agents haven't participated in that. Government employees haven't even participated in that. And when you go to that, you know, who do the postmen and the post offices really work for? You know, they may still carry a name and have a facade looking like it's still government, but it's been subbed out. It's sold out.
It's a private organization, right?
Yeah,
right.
They sold it out to a private. And matter of fact, I don't even think it's an American ownership. And look at our electric company. I think Central Hudson or some of them are governed by Canadians, people that live in, you know, commercial activities in Canada.
Do those sections apply to them?
It doesn't apply to anyone but those people who are doing and participating in alcohol, tobacco, firearms, gasoline, fuels, moving of storage or moving it across roadways or into farming industries. That's it. That's the category of who's liable.
Yeah, but that's the tax code, the Title 26. That's not the
right.
That's not the statutes we're using against them. Those
Well, I think that's what he's talking about. He wants to know who's liable, right? Isn't that what you're looking for?
Well, no. Under the case, you have a list of things that they violated.
Oh, yes.
Okay, in those lists of things that they violated, it says any employee, servant, whatever, under the government, as an employee of the United States government, has to adhere to this code, right?
Well, I think the thing that's going to get them is
where are you looking? What page are you on now?
I was looking at. I just kind of glanced over the case, and then I went down to see what all of the things that they violated. You know how you have them down there, section this, subsection that. You know, and then it starts, out. I'm driving right now, so I can't pull it up and look.
Right.
You know,
yeah, I'm skimming through to look right now to see if I can find where you're talking about, because I need to address directly.
Well, and I could, you know, and I could. Yeah, I mean, I can't pull it up right now to read you quote. This is subsection this and section this, subsection this.
Right.
But
well, when I get into a lot of the codes. If I'm listing out the subsections, is that what you're talking about? There's a list of different subsections. Yeah.
These are the laws that they violated, and then you got a list of the laws that they
violated. Well, remember, there's a heading. IRS has no enforcement. For instance, this is the heading. IRS has no enforcement over the people for failure to file. Okay. Subsection 7604, enforcement refers to a tax for commercial activities on fuels, alcohol, tobacco products, and firearms, and not a tax on salaries. The IRS has no enforcement authority over the people. And then it goes on, because if you look at your papers when they tell you by what authority they act, this is what they say. Whenever the IRS serves notice of enforcement of summons to the people for income tax, include a one-page form, 2039, notice provision of the IRS code. And you see the exhibit, we have exhibit E attached and found also on the website, so on and so forth. But it says, enforcement and summons. Enforcement, whenever any person summons under section 64320. Now remember, a person could be a corporation, it could be a state, it could be a person. So that's the game they play to begin with. But any person summons under this section, 6420, 6421, 6427, and 7602, neglects or refuses to obey such summons or to produce books or papers, records, or other data, or to give testimony as required, the secretary may apply to the judge for the district court or to the United States commissioner for a district within their person to be summoned, reside, or found from attachment against him for contempt. So in order for them to force you to obey the summons, they got to go to a judge, and the judge has to apply it. But it has to apply under 6420 to 6421, 6427, and 7602. So the next series of things I write, well, what does 6420 says? It referenced in 7604. That provides for enforcement of person liable for taxes on gasoline used for farming purposes. Well, that's not me. And then it goes down a rabbit hole referred to in 6420. You got 4081. And again, this is a rabbit hole, and it's legalese, and it's a game they play, but you got to go down the hole. Provides for enforcement of summons for the people liable for taxes on fuel for removal, entry, or sale from any refinery, terminal, to entry into the United States for consumption, use, or warehousing. Then we go to 6421. I don't apply under that, so 2461. Do I apply here? Am I one of the persons? So these are the people that provides for enforcement of summons for people liable for tax and gasoline used in certain highway, non-purpose by local transit systems or sold for certain exempt purposes. Well, that has nothing to do with me. Okay, next one, 6427, references in 7604, provides for enforcement of summons for the sale of any fuel not used for taxable purposes, tobacco products, and firearms under 27 CFR. Well, that has nothing to do with me, so I'm not one of those persons either. Then 7602 provides for under 7604. Under enforcement of summons for execution of books and witnesses for determining the liability of any person relating to tobacco products or cigarette papers and tubes. Well, that has nothing to do with me either. And then there's a rabbit hole, takes you down from 6427, takes you over to 4041. And again, it's legalese, but I went down the whole rabbit hole here. References to that number provides for the imposition of tax on diesel fuels, kerosene, and certain liquids used in fuel or aviation. Well, that's nothing to do with me. 6601, references for interest or non-payment, provides for interest in an underpayment, non-payment, or extension regulations for subsection 6601. That authorizes the collection of interest under 27 CFR for alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, which we don't have nothing, has nothing to do with me. Again,
John,
so we go down. There's one more, huh?
He's talking about the code that we're using against the IRS.
They are giving you the code saying by what authority they act. And here's the last one, 6651, provides for penalties or underpayment, non-payment, or extension regulations for 6651 that authorizes the collection for penalties under 27 CFR for alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Has nothing to do with me. Okay, but people don't go down the rabbit hole. They get this paper, they read the authority, they need to look up those numbers and climb down the rabbit hole to see who they're talking about.
Yeah, but when you're going to sentence them under U.S. code for violating our rights, the U.S. code that you're reading in there, it says this code applies to government employees. You know, people when two people go out in costume on the road and do this, they're talking about.
Well, that's USC 18.
USC. So that USC 18 that we're quoting against them only applies to government employees. And he's
That's USC 18, though. Okay, and yes, we can use those to apply against the people who are abusing this.
That's what he's talking about.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We can use that.
What he's saying is they're not really government employees. I don't agree with him because they're getting a federal check.
Yes, they're operating in commercial activities, so they're part of the government.
So they are an employee, whether they're chartered or they're not chartered. They're getting money. Matter of fact, they're liable to the income tax because it says you only federal employees. You say District of Columbia, right?
Yeah.
They're the ones that are liable.
They have to be participating in those activities. You understand? You got to be selling or moving or participating into importing, exporting fuels, tobacco, firearms, and that's what you got to be participating in. If you're not participating in that activity, 26 has nothing to do with you. That's the point. Okay, so let's get it right off the bat. You don't have nothing to do here. And that's just one, okay? That's just one point of many points that we make in here. You know, when you go through this paper, okay, we make the point that no one is above the law. You know, that's where we start, and we talk about treason and what they're doing and so on and so forth. Title U.S. 26 is not law. It says so within itself. It says in 26 U.S.C. 7806B establishes that Title 26 U.S.C. is not to infer or presume to be law, and therefore cannot have any legal effect because there exists no intent of law, and thereby the courts cannot conclude presumption in law by the grouping of any particular section or provision or portion of Title 26. Okay, and that's right there in USC Title 26, USC 7806, no inference, no implication, no presumption, no legislative or enactment of law, no construction shall be drawn or made by reason of locations or grouping or any particular section or provision or portion of this title, nor shall any table of contents, table of cross-references, or similar outlines, analysis, and descriptive matters relating to the contents of this title be given any legal effect. The preceding sentence also applies to the side notes and the ancillary tables contained in various prints in the acts before its enactment into law. Okay, so nothing. Again, U.S. 26 isn't even law, and it certainly cannot apply. Even if it was law, it doesn't apply to the people. People are not under the thumb of legislation. The 16th Amendment, another position we made. The 16th Amendment does not authorize a tax on salary. Okay, the IRS has no enforcement over the people for failure to file. We went through that with all those codes that we just went through.
Well, let me ask you something. Does the government have a right to tax a federal paycheck if you're getting
No.
They don't?
No, of course not, because
if
they're not...
If you're a federal employee, they don't have the right to tax your check.
No, absolutely not. They're people. Even though they're employed by the government, they're under codes, but they're people. But they're not selling. They're not dealing with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, and gasoline, and fuels, and movement over highways, and refinery. They're not involved in any of that.
Well, you just took all their money away.
Yes, everything.
Okay, but what about me as a truck driver?
The same thing. They have no authority over you. Whoever's providing the fuel takes care of the problem of the fuel. You pay the tax at the pump.
Okay.
You don't worry about that.
Right.
It's done. You see, all the money that they're supposed to be paying, they're taxing it to the people who are taking that material, you know, like gas and oil. You know, we're buying that stuff.
Right.
We don't have to pay the tax. We just don't buy it, and we don't pay the tax. But
right.
it's not a direct tax. It's an indirect tax, and that's lawful. And it definitely is used
right.
and needed for, you
I
know, highways. And
the gas.
Right.
Right.
IRS has no authority to ask the people for information. We cover that under 6001, 6011, and 6012. Again, they're regulations. They have no authority over that. We the people, can refuse to produce records to the IRS agents. And believe me, this is a big part of this whole thing. The Fifth Amendment plays a role in that. Okay, the IRS notice of lien is a felony. Every time they file a lien, it's a lie, it's a fraud, because it doesn't exist in the federal district courts. That's a felony. That's a crime. And it's RICO.
Okay, but my question is, I think Gerard's got a better handle on what my question is.
Okay.
Is, do these USC Title 18 section so-and-so codes that were...
It applies to the category with the people that are in. In Title 18, it deals with criminal activities, okay? And that umbrellas all of the codes, okay? Anybody working for the government, anybody working in and participating in commercial activities, especially interstate activities and so on, all of that stuff.
They're not working for the government.
But if you're contracted out to deal with commercial activities, we gave them the power and the authority to write law on that. And it's in one of the 57 titles. And so they have to live by that code when they do the business with the government or through the process to go, you know, because the government has to regulate it and has to make sure everything is lawful and moves through and so on and so forth. So, yeah, they operate. There's a commercial agreement there. And if they don't want to be part of that commercial agreement, go find another business. Go open up a ma and pa deli or something, you know, do whatever else. Get out of that business. But anything that gets involved with interstate commerce, it is controlled by the federal government. We gave them the authority under Article 1, Section 8 to do that. But we were very specific on how, what, and what, how far they can go with this. And again, we have the capital.
The
point is, they're a foreign corporation.
But the IRS employees aren't members of our government.
No, but they're working in commercial activities for a private organization, a corporation, because they are a corporation. It's a private corporation, and their services are purchased for the purpose of collecting the taxes, and they you know, that's their purpose. But they're not a government agency. But they're in the commercial activity. They're in the commercial activity. They're in the. They're there to collect the monies. They're participating in commercial activity to make sure that they collect the money for fuel, firearms, and so on, tobacco, and.
Okay.
So that's what that whole thing is about. Now USC 18 applies to them, and any, because they're under USC 26. if they were under some other code, operating under some other agency, then they still, all the agencies, all of the 56 plus 7 codes, all of the 56 codes fall under USC 18 for criminal activities, you know, that could be applied upon them. So that's sort of like a blanket thing for criminal activities. Because that's what USC 18 is mostly about. Not all. There's other things. But they all have to abide by that. And that's where we get any of these agents come out on the road and they incarcerate us without due process and all that stuff. That's kidnapping, and that's what they're talking about, going out on the road and kidnapping.
Okay,
and should death occur, and so on and so forth.
Okay, well, when I was reading through the violations that they've made, you know, my mind went to, well, they're exempt from this because they're not employees of the government. So,
no, they're not employees of the government. The IRS just surfaced and became an agency amongst the other federal agencies, and I think it was 1970 or 71 or 72, beginning of the 70s, they just appeared there. There was no legislative act to grant them, to put them into that position. There's nothing to bring them into existence, nothing. They just appeared there in the early 70s.
Yeah, so they're operating under color of law. It doesn't matter if they're not employees. They're putting on a robe of a judge or the robe of a cop or an IRS agent. So that's like me putting a cop uniform on and trying to arrest Jay.
They are operating under USC 18. When you have all of these, what do they call that, the trafficking going on, let's say the sex trafficking. Okay, that's not a lawful business, but it is trafficking. It's interstate. It's moving things and product, which is an illegal product to move, which is sex.
And it's under color of law. That's the blanket thing.
The thing is that falls under USC 18. They have every right to go after them federally and to charge them federally and to exercise, try to get an indictment and a conviction federally.
I think that they're covered under the fact that they're in disguise of a federal agency.
Yes,
they're wearing a disguise and they're doing it under color of law, so therefore they broke the law. They come under that. You understand?
Yeah, they got
what
a
I'm
badge.
Saying?
They got a uniform.
They got a gun. Right. So and they're operating outside their authority. So I don't care if they're from Mars or they're not a federal employee or what they are. The fact that they're operating, telling you that you're breaking this law and I'm the official, and they're not really.
The fact that they're operating under commercial activities interstate, collecting interstate, they fall under USC 18. No matter what, even not being federal employees.
But they are
operating under color of law because they're not even who they say they are.
Yeah, and I think that covers them for their fines. I think that that applies to them.
Absolutely, no doubt about it. We use it all the time.
So I think that's the answer to Jay's question. That's why they fall under those codes, those penalties, because they're operating under color of law.
Okay.
So somebody they're not. So I don't care, where they're getting their paycheck or anything. They're still coming after you saying that they're the law, and they're not. And that's covered in that code.
Well, it's good to hear from you, Jay. It's been a while since we heard your voice, so good to see you. And with that, I think we should shut down, though.
Yeah, because I got no more wheels on my pumpkin anymore.
Yeah, I know. There's a couple more people in the cube. Hopefully we'll get them next week. We'll run out of time. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Don't forget, Thursday, we're coming together for an indictment.
Consideration of indictments,
two indictments, one concerning the federal judiciary, the other concerning the IRS activities and others involved in both cases
That's why I wanted to ask this question tonight, because I'm reading this, and I wanted to better understand it as I'm thinking it through.
Right.
And I'm going to donate $100 here pretty soon.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Jay.
It's been a while since I've done that, so.
Appreciate it. Anyway, we will be here Thursday, and there is, I believe that there is absolutely no conflict of interest for the people to rise up, even in a grand jury, to say, stop violating these unalienable rights, even though, there's an interest here, but it's not a conflict of interest, it's a law. So, I don't believe that people that are going after, that are going to participate in the IRS, that they can be denied sitting on the grand jury for that. Absolutely. It's like being, you know, sitting on the Second Amendment. Everybody's going to, that knows the Constitution before they even look at the evidence, knows that it shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't infringe upon that, and they're infringing upon my right because I don't tell me I can't have a gun. So there's a conflict of interest because I'm the target of their slavery movement, which is disarm me first, tax the hell out of me till I can't afford to do anything, and then totally seize control of everything at some point, which is where they're heading. No, we can't let them do that. So,
well, and every W-4 form that I've filled out for an employee for the last, like, 15 years, I've put on there under duress, because they tell you, you know, you can't work here unless you fill this out. I put on there under duress, UCC 1207, sign my name and write all rights reserved.
Well, that's good for that. That's a good way to do that. Or just all rights reserved might be sufficient. But that's good. That
so
kind of protects
I'm being,
you. But remember, you're even protected.
To be able to have a job to
right.
Survive,
they boxed
you know?
Us in. Look, you can't even get a bank account without a Social Security card. I mean, look at, you know, you need a birth certificate. You need a Social Security card. Everybody needs a bank, and everybody needs to drive. Who wants to be beat up and harassed all the time because you don't have a driver's license? You know, all these things, they box us in. But because we're conforming to that, we don't have a choice. They forced us into, they coerced us. Therefore, it's null and void. It means nothing.
Yeah.
So, and that's the position.
I get that.
You know, people have to think this out a little bit. And whenever you think it out and you start looking at the law, the real law, which is the common law, and see what's going on, and you think it out and you come back and you think some more, believe me, it's going to grow. You know, your position and your understanding is going to grow, and you're going to be able to make good positions and arguments.
Even though I did sign that, I wanted to leave a paper trail saying, you know, I'm not really cool with signing this.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's a good way to do it. I wouldn't argue with that. I know a lot of the people out there and the man on the land stuff teach a lot of that stuff, but that's one place I would agree to put that next to your signature, and it would be helpful in the future should you have to pull that paper out.
Yeah.
Make sure you have a copy of that.
I would be able to get a copy from
Yeah, you should get a copy and put it in your safe. Get a copy and put it in your safe. Absolutely. Okay, with that, we're gone. Okay, again, Thursday, we're going to be here at 9 o'clock. It'll be a very quick meeting. Everybody should be homeworked up on the work there to look at the case, to be able to come in prepared to make a vote. So it'll only take minutes, 10 minutes or so, and you'll be gone. So it's a very short meeting. And then, of course, Monday, we'll be back here again, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for our open forum and the things we do here. And we will be opening a little earlier at 8:30 for people who may have questions and concerns about the IRS that want to join up with us and with questions on the affidavit that they have to fill out and the process or anything. You know, we'll be there. But again, most of that should be answered through intake. But if you need to, you can bring it up on that point. Okay, and also with the militia. You know, we should talk more about the militia and some of the problems with the people resisting becoming educated properly because their fear that we're some kind of a national group to take over national control and that there's a national militia. No. It's the National Militia Alliance just coming into an alliance. They're under the county at the grassroots level, working with and for the people and under the auspices of the sheriff in most cases. But not necessarily. They're free to step up on their own to do the right thing, even if the sheriff doesn't agree with them. If they know they have to protect the Constitution, even above the sheriff, they have the unalienable right to do so. Okay. Good night, everybody. See you next time.